In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Apparently, three bullets were found. The president was rushed by Secret Service to Parkland Memorial Hospital, 4 miles from Dealey Plaza. We are told a bullet entered the base of the throat and came out of the backside, but there is no confirmation. A priest has administered the last rites.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of JFK.
Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Back and to the left.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Sean Ray.
And I think it'd make a great president, a really handsome one too.
Hosted by Arnie.
Your mouse fighting a gorilla.
Stuart.
This is too fucking big for you, you know that?
And Jacob.
You just talk to us on the record, we'll protect you, I guarantee it.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Everything I'm going to tell you is classified top secret.
Anybody want to quit?
Listener discretion is advised.
So what really happened that day? Let's just for a moment speculate, shall we?
Today, we're discussing the movie that, if you use it during the Kevin Bacon game, you're cheating, JFK, starring Kevin Costner, Donald Sutherland, John Larroquette, Kevin Bacon, Ed Asner.
I'm going to get up and go to the bathroom. This is going to take a while.
William Altman's, Tommy Lee Jones, Brian Doyle Murray, Thomas Millen, Laurie Metcalf, John Candy, Gary Grubbs, Gary Oldman, Sally Kirkland, Ron Rifkin, Michael Rooker, Wayne Knight, Peter Maloney, J.O. Sanders, Pruitt Taylor, John Finnegan, Sissy Spacek, Tony Plana, Wayne Tippett, Joe Pesci, Vincent D'Onofrio, Bob Gunton, Bretta Bosniak, Dale Dye, Frank Whaley, Jack Lemmon, Lolita Davidovich, Jim Garrison, and Walter fucking Matthau. This is the Now Playing podcast co-host who feels like a patsy, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is the co-host who, all I wanted in this world was to be a Catholic priest, but I had one terrible fucking weakness. Podcasting. This is Jacob.
Is that what did it in for you?
That's what did it in. They heard my review, my not recommend for Infinity War, and they're like, nope, sorry. You cannot bless the communion.
The doors slam, yep.
Infinity War is canonized, and so is Sean Ray, our patron who has picked this movie. He was anxious to have us do some Oliver Stone. He said when he joined us on the last podcast, his favorite was Platoon. He thinks Stone was great between Salvador and JFK being his last good film, when his messages were, as Sean puts it, still sincere and not a gimmick. And then everything out of it, he feels, has been a bad filmmaker imitating himself ever since.
Hmm. Okay. Which would include Natural Born Killers and Nixon. And have we done any of the later ones, Alexander? I don't think so.
We did Natural Born Killers. I mean, and this is our third Oliver Stone review. This year, we get two. We did Born on the 4th of July and JFK. And then back in, I think, 2015, we did Natural Born Killers.
Right. This is where Oliver Stone, to me, pioneered the deep state, right? Like, this is where he got in trouble. Up to this point, he's a multiple Oscar winner. He brought the subject of Vietnam to its rightful importance in the 80s. And I felt like people on all sides of the political aisle celebrated his work. After he made this film, man, like, you were either for him or against him. He made it very hard for people to be in the middle because so many looked at him as unpatriotic, crazy, paranoid, using circumstantial evidence to put forward an agenda.
Okay, you've summed up my summary. Good night. Talk to you guys later.
To me, that's not a bad thing. If you have an agenda, if you have pretension, if you have things to say, then step on up. I'm fine with that. Be a good filmmaker. Use your tools wisely. And even if I don't agree with the message, I could probably still be impressed with the packaging.
Well, Sean does ask, what do we three think of his career? And if fans, what's your favorite Stone film?
I would say I've seen almost everything. I think Savages might be the only one that I skipped.
Awful. Yeah. Don't watch it.
Yeah, but I feel like almost any other one that you could name, I saw, even the early ones, The Hand. No one even wants to talk about The Hand. Michael Caine's hand rips off and chases him around. I'm serious.
So don't talk to The Hand?
That's an Oliver Stone film?
It is. He likes to begin at Platoon, but there were ones before. Here's what I feel about Stone, is like he makes these important movies that in the moment are discussion points. People at the water cooler gotta talk about it. And then next week, I don't remember. I don't go back to them, is the truth. I see them, I forget them, I have varying opinions about them. You know, we talked about with Born on the 4th of July and Natural Born Killers, he likes polarities. There's not a lot of moral gray in his work. There's good people, there's bad people, and I think that's always my knock on him. He has a sanctimonious quality that he has the truth and others are moral failings, and that can be irritating.
Yeah, I've only seen a handful of his films, and I don't know, I hear Oliver Stone, and I think, oh, this is a big-time director, you know, Tarantino, Kubrick, you know, all those directors where you just hear their name and you know their body of work. I feel like Stone has that reputation, but every time I watch one of his films, and, you know, I recommended Born on 4th of July, but I wasn't passionate about it. I've seen Platoon, it's fine, I guess, like, but I haven't fell in love with anything I've seen from him. I guess what you're saying is right, Stuart, is that he hits a tone at the right moment that gets into that zeitgeist, and then it kind of just goes away. And so watching these films years, decades later, they just feel flat to me.
And I'm kind of there with you. I have not seen all of his films, but I've seen over half of them. As far as what my favorite is, I would oscillate between Natural Born Killers or The Doors.
I would have pegged you for a Wall Street guy.
Wall Street, as you said, Stuart, meant so much to me in 1987. And then in 1997, not so much. And by 2012, when I got around to seeing Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps, I realized the franchise probably should have. It had a big effect on me as a child, but I don't think it's a great movie. I don't know if I'd recommend it. I haven't seen it since I did the double feature with Money Never Sleeps. But Natural Born Killers was my movie the year it came out. You could not stop me from listening to that soundtrack, seeing it in theaters multiple times. But The Doors was like a spiritual experience for me. I'd never seen a movie quite like that. So hard for me to pick between those two. If forced, I think I'll go with The Doors. I rewatched it the other day. It holds up. It's one of the few, I think, that actually does hold up because it's about a historical figure and not about the time it was made.
Favorite's hard because, again, I only see them once, usually, and so they're very distant memories. But my memory is Salvador or Nixon would have been my favorite.
Well, I remember seeing JFK with you, Stuart, in theaters. It was the Dollar Theater, and I feel we always say this, but a lot of people don't know what a Dollar Theater was.
They don't even know what a movie theater is now.
It's going to get to that point. But when it took about a year for a movie to get to video after it premiered in theaters, it would be in theaters for a few months, and then there'd be the dingy, not well-kept theater that used to be the thing 30 years before and now is barely running, and they'd send second-run movies there. And at the time we saw this, it was a dollar. When I saw Tomb Raider there, I think they'd upped it to $2. But it was a dollar movie, and I'd heard a lot of things about JFK. I'd seen Wall Street and Born on the 4th of July by this point. And so I was like, yeah, they're, with all the buzz around JFK, give it a go.
Yeah, and my memory was, I was not a good history student. I'll just put it that way. I was in high school and really resenting having to study American history. And so I couldn't connect with the controversy about how accurate the movie was or not. I just sort of related to the paranoia and the idea that the powers that be could, in fact, use their influence to do harm was something that I bought into. I remember feeling it was confusing whenever they tried to say that Tommy Lee Jones or Joe Pesci was pulling the trigger. That part I was like, I'm not sure about that. But I remembered thinking it was a good movie about a moment in history that I didn't know a lot about.
My memory was that I think I fell asleep in the theater. Either that or I was hypnotized. My only memory felt like 3 hours of Kevin Costner standing at a slide projection speaking and mostly saying back and to the left.
Yeah, I saw this originally under less than ideal movie watching circumstances, probably a few years after it came out in theaters when it was available on video. I was actually up in Lake Tahoe at a family reunion with my dad and his sisters, all my cousins, and we had this very nice big cabin on right on the lake, and we were stuck inside because it was horrible rain going on, stuck inside playing Hearts, and like one of my uncles pulled out JFK and like put that on, so as we played cards, this was going on in the background. I probably remember more from the Seinfeld parody of Back and to the Left than this actual film going into it.
Both have Wayne Knight involved.
Yes, that blew my mind when I saw Wayne Knight show up in this film.
I remember it, as I've already framed, it was a controversial movie when it came out, and there were a lot of people that wrote a lot of pieces in the press about what they thought about it, even before they even saw it. It's a movie I don't remember my reaction to as much as my father's, because my dad was a huge Oliver Stone fan. Platoon and all of that. He was going to see everything that he ever made until he found out about this movie. And my dad was passionate that the Warren Commission lone gunman theory was the only one to believe in. Every other person was a conspiracy nut. Even worse, the fact that he was going to take the position of Jim Garrison. Again, I knew no history. That meant nothing to me. He swore up and down, I will never see an Oliver Stone movie again. Now, I did ask him. I called him up this week. I was like, did you ever see it? He's like, oh, yeah, it was shit. But he hasn't changed his position that Jim Garrison is not someone to listen to. But he did eventually break down. And it, again, it turned fans into enemies because it is taking a stance that, frankly, Hollywood doesn't usually do. Usually you want to get consensus. Usually you want to tell things in a way that will bring in the most audiences. I think what is striking about JFK, if nothing else that you can celebrate about it, it's a minority position. It was someone who came to this with an outsider perspective, and Warner Brothers said, okay, here's $40 million. You can tell a story that many people don't want you to.
$40 million. Wow. That seems like a huge, huge investment in this.
That is, but again, two Oscars. He had won Best Director, Born on the 4th of July. He had won for Platoon. All of his other films were seen. He's really considered an important filmmaker. So if he is going to take on the JFK assassination, and you got a lot of stars that want to work with him. That's why this cast is ballooning with all of the who's who of Hollywood, is that, you know, he had his pick. Whoever wanted, you know, to work with Oliver Stone, they would sign on to this script unseen. And many of them did not know the script. It was a hush-hush project. Stone was introduced to it. Basically, Jim Garrison wrote a book in 1988 called On the Trail of Assassins, and that was brought to him on the set of Born on the 4th of July. He read it three times and said, I want this to be my next film, but we need to flesh it out. So we went and bought another book that is actually a really good book, Crossfire.
Yeah, I noticed that there's two books that this is based on.
Crossfire is really good. No matter what your persuasion is on the case, it is a compendium of all of the different theories out there and does a very good job of citing things and referencing. So all of the detail work, all of the factual, I'll use that word loosely, but all of the factual stuff that is known about that day in Dealey Plaza, that comes from Crossfire. And then the frame of the story is Jim Garrison. Those are the two books. Now, I read those two, and I also read False Witness, which, wow, okay. It was the rebuttal to Jim Garrison. It actually went back to the actual court case and showed what actually happened there. I think you can get confused watching this movie thinking that it's all about who shot Kennedy, and you forget that there was a man in the room who was in San Francisco on the day that it happened, and he stands accused of something.
Yeah, I didn't forget that. When I'm watching this movie for this review, I'm like, does anyone care about Tommy Lee Jones in this trial? What are they talking about?
Oh, I was like, this is the worst trial ever. Like, why is Tommy Lee Jones even there? This isn't about him. I would be upset if I was him.
You don't even know the half of it. I was, yes, False Witness. Like, I was livid after reading that book. I watched this movie again for a second time, read that book, then watched the director's cut of this movie. It changed my perspective instantly. It's quite amazing how Stone can take sanctimonious ideas about this is the truth and then just so flagrantly change things that are known into absolute lies. And I get it. I get both sides. I get why my dad would never see this movie, and I get why people are passionate and feel like it's history making, because it did actually get the Congress and political powers that be to reopen the case, create a new committee, and get documents declassified and put out.
Oh, I know, because this film brags about it at the end. I guess they added that on with the Blu-ray or something. But yes, this movie got more documents released the next year. It's very proud of that, I could tell.
And I got to admit, coming into this, though, I did know about JFK's assassination and the magic bullet theory, and it sounds like a cover-up to me. I mean, that makes no sense that a bullet would zigzag that way.
Read the actual evidence and how they came to that theory. There's a lot of holes in it.
Yeah, I've never believed the lone gunman theory, even before I saw this movie. So I feel like the X-Files took from this movie a hell of a lot, down to the mysterious kind of deep throat character. So I came into this movie basically before there was an X-File saying, I want to believe. Tell me the truth about what happened on that grassy knoll.
So are you a conspiracy guy, Arnie? Because I know, to me, I'm just very adverse to conspiracy theories. I think they're not usually true. I work in a government bureaucracy. It's very inefficient. No one can keep secrets. Like, if you understand human psychology, it's very hard. And yes, there have been conspiracies that have been done by the government. MK Ultra and telling black men that they're curing their disease and they're not. They were just giving them placebos. Like, yes, that stuff has happened and it's come out because that's what usually happens. But the Warren Commission, no, I don't think it's 100% accurate. I think there probably was a second shooter. I can't go this far, though. I listen to a lot of Coast to Coast because I think it's funny, not because I believe.
I'm not really a big conspiracy guy. I believe in Occam's razor, that given any situation, the simplest explanation is most likely the correct explanation. But I also do know that things have been uncovered. Another Oliver Stone film, Snowden. I am very pro-Snowden. So there are cases of cover-ups. There are cases of conspiracies.
Yeah, but it came out. That's the thing. It got out.
So that's your measure of it. If it's only something that's an allegation and no facts are revealed within 5 years, 10 years?
I mean, it's been, what, 60 years almost since this happened?
Yeah, the 57th anniversary is this coming Tuesday.
And the number of people that all the strings that are going to be tied and pieced together in this film, like no one's broke and spoke out, nothing's come out, it's too much. Go to Occam's razor. I agree, Arnie.
I do feel like Oliver Stone in this film is that meme from Always Sunny in yes. Philadelphia of Charlie Day, the board with all the strings.
I would put it this way. I feel like in reading Crossfire, again, the book's point was not to take a position. It was to show you all of the inconsistencies and then talk about all the different theories. I do think that Oliver Stone in this movie is not trying to say his view of what happened per se. A little bit towards certain moments, I'll bring it up. I do think I hear him name a name many times throughout this, but I feel like what's more important to him is that you believe there is a deep state. He pioneered that concept.
So he's a big Trump supporter.
No, it used to belong to the left. That's what's been kind of funny about watching. It used to be conservatives thought our government doesn't do anything wrong, and you crazy hippies and your allegations of the FBI and CIA, if you didn't act like such asses, they wouldn't investigate you. But now it's for everyone, right? In the 30 years since this movie, we now feel like we live in times where everyone has a right to be paranoid about what's going on. And they can be on really radically different areas of the political spectrum and still see deep state all over the place.
It is crazy, no pun intended, the level of insane conspiracy theories that you hear that make no sense whatsoever. I don't even get the point of a lot of the conspiracy theories out there and why people would believe them. QAnon.
QAnon, yes.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like there are things to be suspicious about, and then there are plots that defy all logic. Like, I don't know how people come to that conclusion. I'd like to believe I don't subscribe to any of those, but I can understand why people are suspicious of their government. That is not a foreign concept for me. I think for any of us, growing up after Vietnam, Watergate, I don't feel like the U.S. government has ever fully recovered from those scandals. In fact, they've multiplied, and we now reach a point where we don't trust whole administrations.
Yeah, I mean, Iran-Contra continued. It wasn't nearly as big as the two you mentioned, but yet another case of the government on the line for secret dealings. you can't trust a politician is what it comes down to. I don't care what party they are.
Well, there you go. See? You're in the camp then, Arnie.
Here's the thing. I don't think the government has changed. It's always done this kind of thing. It's always set up puppet governments. It's the people that have changed after the 60s and the hippies. Like, we became more suspicious. Like, the government's always been corrupt. We just caught on to it finally.
Well, then I think you guys are a little bit more tinfoil hat than you're letting on here. You are all on the same page here as Oliver Stone.
No, I believe that there's people that want to keep their power and their money, like people who were briefed on the coronavirus before it even made it out of the news and just happened to sell all their stock the day before it broke. So they made a lot of money. Like, yeah, I believe in that kind of stuff. I believe that people are corrupt. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, corruption is one thing, but conspiracy takes it to the next level. Conspiracy is more than Martha Stewart selling some stock based on a tip.
I know people that have really lost their minds due to believing in conspiracies. Like, very troubling things have happened to them. And just, it's something I'm just very wary of because I've seen the effects it could have on someone when they get lost on this stuff. Like, I am fascinated by flat earthers. Like, my wife gets so sick of it because if there's a flat earther documentary, I'm watching it because, again, the psychology is interesting to me. If you watch Under the Dome on Netflix, like, they prove two or three times in that film, these flat earthers prove that the world is a globe, that it's round, but they can't accept that evidence. Like, it's fascinating on that level, but I do think it's dangerous to get into it if you get too deep into it.
I think that is the fuzzy line. And I think, again, when I think about my dad, he just doesn't want to go there because anyone that crosses over into that area to him has gone into an illegitimate realm. You have to believe things that come out of a newspaper. And I think that's just the world that he came from. And so he wasn't willing to go to JFK. I was. Maybe I was even doing it as an act of rebellion. I was a teenager, after all. The movie made money. It's worth pointing out, $70 million in the U.S. at that time for this kind of film is good, $200 million worldwide, and it got a lot of Oscar attention. It won editing and cinematography, and it was up for a lot of other ones. Lost most of them to Silence of the Lambs and Curly. Jack Palance stole the supporting actor Oscar from Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, God. You know, one thing this movie made me think about that's also out of vogue, though, not that it's a bad thing, but presidential assassinations.
You better be careful about that. I mean, we're recording this show before the election. Like, I wouldn't be so confident that that's not in the news.
I mean, there was a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan and, like, start a race for.
But I don't know if it's just that Secret Service has gotten better or people are being stupid like those people who wanted to kidnap the governor and created their own, what, Facebook group or something to do it. It was really stupid. But I think the closest we got was 1981, where that guy shot Reagan to impress Jodie Foster.
John Hinckley.
That is a political assassination. That wasn't close to it. That was it.
He was hit with a bullet.
Yeah, we got the Brady Bill out of that.
No, I'm saying we haven't had one in 40 years.
You're saying they weren't successful, is what you're saying.
I'm merely discussing that to two generations, the thought of killing a president is a completely foreign concept. We grew up, and we were all very young when Reagan was shot, but I was well aware that Reagan was shot, and I was very afraid the president dying in that moment. And my entire view of the world was shaped by the thought that a president or a pope, the popes were getting assassinated a lot too. Presidents and popes could go at any time.
Well, okay, that's very distorted because we've only had three, right? I mean, in the whole history of America, they've only taken out three. So, law of averages, the president's going to live through their term.
A lot die in their term, but
no, what are you talking about? I can think of one other one.
Harrison, Taylor, Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, Harding, Roosevelt, Kennedy. 8.
Okay, that's more than I would have thought.
I mean, 8 out of 45.
Yeah, still a small average, and most of them at a time where mortality rates were more common for middle-aged people in general.
But is this the last time a president took a ride in a convertible? I'm thinking so.
It's gotta be.
Sure. Now, which version did you guys see? Obviously, seeing it in theaters, you guys saw the theatrical, but did you go back and watch the extended by 16-minute director's cut?
Nope, 3 hours and 26 minutes was enough for me. I didn't need it any longer.
No, that's it. Then you saw the director's cut.
Yeah, my cut was 3 hours and 5 minutes, and I'm happy with it.
Yeah, you saw the long one, Jacob. Yeah. If you saw John Larroquette doing Johnny Carson, you saw the longer cut.
Okay, I did see that. Dang it!
I thought I was watching the shorter version.
Yeah, you guys seem to remember this movie as being exceedingly long, but my memory was that it was a fast 3 hours. And I don't even know that sitting down for 3 hours is a thing for people anymore in the age of binging.
My memory was a lot of the trial, and that's like the last half hour. Like, I had forgotten all the stuff before that.
Yeah, I remember walking out of the theater with you, Stuart, and we just had vastly different opinions about this movie. And I was like, my God, did I waste my life watching Kevin Costner give a lecture? And you're like, what are you talking about?
So you didn't like it. I can't remember your response to it. I really don't.
Again, I can't remember if I fell asleep or if it just like put me into a trance. But I remember feeling trapped.
Arnie, that was the government actually treated the screens to put people in trances so they wouldn't pay attention to the film. It's another conspiracy.
At the dollar theater to get the poor. I wanted to know about JFK, and I walked out of this movie feeling like it was speechifying.
Okay, too much talking.
No, talking as in dialogue is one thing. Speechifying, watching it a second time, I'm not going to change my mind on this. Kevin Costner standing in front of a screen monologuing for 30 minutes.
It is like someone just reading a Reddit conspiracy theory board.
You're talking about the ending. I mean,
I'm talking about most of the film.
That's all I remembered from coming back, though, was the ending. And I felt like walking out of the theater, all I was thinking about was the ending and how it didn't even feel cinematic to me then.
Here's something to know. Stone, call it pretentious, I will, but maybe that's not a bad thing. He does not consider himself a filmmaker. He has coined the term cinematic historian. That is the way he sees himself, that he wants JFK, he actually said this, I want JFK to replace the Warren Commission like Roots replaced Uncle Tom's Cabin. I want it to be seen as a historical document that builds on the strong anti-Vietnam War sentiments that I already set up in Platoon and Born on the 4th of July. So he, I think, if it feels like a history lesson or lecture, I don't think that he would consider that criticism.
He may not, but I send it to him as such.
Now, have you guys been to Daly Plaza? Have you checked this out? Because right before I moved back to California from Dallas, I'm like, oh, I got to do all that Dallas tourist stuff since I don't know when I'll be back here. You know, first I had to go hit all the RoboCop sites, go see the OCP building that they used to film RoboCop at. But then, yes, I went to Daly Plaza and went to the book depository and checked all that out. They got little X's on the actual street where the bullets hit JFK. Like, it's very interesting.
I went down there around 2010. I was in Dallas a lot because there were a lot of Star Wars happenings in Dallas at that time. And yeah, we went and did the book depository tour, and the grassy knoll is so small, you know?
It is, yes.
Watching this movie, hearing all the discussions about the grassy knoll, and then you stand on the grassy knoll, you're like, how many people could they really fit in here?
Also called a median. Yeah, it really is just, it's just a traffic stop. There's nothing remarkable about it.
It's like literally right before you get on the freeway. You go down the street and you go on the on-ramp and get on the freeway. Like, it's not very remarkable. Like, it just seems like a street corner almost.
I don't know of anyone who's ever said, go to the Knoll. Any place in my life, the only time I hear the word Knoll used is in this Dallas case.
Yeah, I thought they did a really good job. They have turned the sixth floor into a museum. They have the rifle sights up there. And they really, if you geek out about this stuff, and I kind of do, I mean, I want to just put it out there that this movie did make me more interested in history. It did make me want to ask questions. I did continue to read books every now and then, maybe more like magazine articles, I'll be honest. But I was fascinated by this moment in history and do agree with Stone that it does signify a break in how we look at America. It's a clear demarcation between an idealistic time and a cynical time.
I agree with that. I think that the country lost its innocence. It lost its virginity when JFK was shot, and it's never been the same. From what I understand, talking to my parents who were born in the 40s, my godparents who were born in the 20s and the teens, it was a very big changing of the way people saw the country.
If Now Playing was a boomer podcast, and instead of all the 9/11 references we make, it'd all be JFK. Like, I remember my dad always telling me that every person that was alive when that happened, they remember where they were, what they were doing when they heard the president was shot. It was a huge, impactful moment.
I remember when I was a kid, I'd hear people say to each other, "Where were you when Kennedy was shot?" And at first I didn't get it, and then I got it, and I'm like, oh, well, I didn't exist yet. I'll never have that. Oh, where were you at 9/11? Yeah.
All right, so if it's this significant, Arnie, you got to give him the plot, and then we'll discuss everything in JFK.
I can't do that. I don't know the plot.
Kevin Costner talks a lot, and then there's a trial.
Kevin Costner uncovers the plot through the movie. I'll summarize it thusly. Kevin Costner plays New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. Immediately following the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963, Garrison begins to investigate. Yes, the killing happened in Dallas, but suspected killer Lee Harvey Oswald, played by Gary Oldman, spent the previous summer in New Orleans. Garrison and his team look into several associates of Oswald's, but the case is abandoned when Oswald is killed by Jack Ruby, played by Brian Doyle Murray.
How did Bill Murray not show up in this film, but his brother does?
I was watching Get a Life a lot on Fox with...
Great show.
Brian Doyle Murray was the father there. Then I come in here and he's killing Oswald? Wow, that was a mind fuck. But Garrison can't let it go. When the Warren Report is released, Garrison finds falsehoods as well as contradictions. As such, he reopens the investigation, looking into Oswald's military history, his pro-communist activities in New Orleans, and his ties to a wealthy businessman named Clay Shaw, played by Tommy Lee Jones. The investigation has a great personal cost to Garrison, straining his marriage to wife Liz, played by Sissy Spacek, but still, Garrison charges Shaw with conspiracy to commit murder. In the courtroom, Garrison speechifies his entire theory about how Kennedy was really killed. There were three shooters, not one, but I can't even remember him talking about Shaw, so the jury finds him not guilty as credits roll.
And as it starts, the drum rolls, the horn, to sin by silence when we should protest makes cowards out of men. It is your civic duty, damn it, to watch this movie. They just lay it on thick that this is an experience that all Americans must do. And a prologue, too, just to catch you up, give some context. Martin Sheen is going to spend 5 minutes basically framing history so that it makes sense from an Oliver Stone perspective.
I don't even think this is a prologue. This is his thesis statement, military-industrial complex. Like, that's what it's going to start with. Not Kennedy, but Eisenhower.
Yeah, I mean, that's ultimately he is naming. That's what you would do in an essay. And I do feel like this could be described as a film essay more than a narrative. The film essay starts by saying, I believe the military-industrial complex killed John F. Kennedy. And we're going to start with the former president, in that very famous farewell address. That's one thing I do remember from history class, was the fact that this general, you know, World War II, you would think he would be so pro-military, ended the whole thing by saying, watch out for these guys.
Yeah, I actually appreciated this look into that period of history. I didn't realize that at the time this movie was made, Kennedy was one of the narrowest victories in history, not counting the two that lost the popular vote, because the 100,000 votes he won by had to be popular vote. There aren't that many electoral votes. I thought the entire country loved Kennedy. I couldn't imagine a world where everybody loved the president, but with the Cuban Missile Crisis, him getting us through that and everything, and the fact that, as we said, we viewed this as a loss of American innocence, I had no idea that there was such a partisan view of Kennedy at the time and that he won so narrowly.
Oh, yeah, I agree. It's something that, because they, you know, Camelot, right? Like, they even crafted it themselves. We're bringing this new magical realm into existence. Whenever we lose someone young, Kurt Cobain, I like Nirvana, but like to watch his legacy after he died, the way that he died, it has a lot to do with our own issues with mortality and people dying young. James Dean, he made 3 films. Why are we still talking about him? But something happens when promise is cut short. And Kennedy never got to prove whether he was going to be a good president or not. He talked a good game, but we will never know. And that is what people get stuck on.
Yeah, I guess what I didn't really realize is he was inaugurated in 61, assassinated 63, like just 2 years. I don't know, for whatever reason, it seemed like he was president forever and then assassinated. I didn't realize he was there just for such a short term.
Yeah. And again, he inherited something. It is worth pointing out, because I always assume Bay of Pigs was him. He inherited that. he showed up, and a couple weeks later, the CIA is like, by the way, we're working with the mob and the Cubans, and we're going to go get Castro. And he's like, what? Like, what are you talking about? So this is what Eisenhower was talking about. And when that failed, that was when he realized he couldn't trust those people. And he did a lot of moves. This is what this thesis is explaining to us. He did a lot of moves in those 2 years to pull away from their influence. Would he have pulled out of Vietnam?
No, that is not true.
That is in dispute. There are many historians that would tell you he was still going to go there. I've read a lot in this past week about his policies on that, and it's a mixed message. And he was playing a game of saying one thing publicly and doing other things privately. We can't know for sure. To Stone, because Stone sees everything through the vantage point of Vietnam, this was the man that was going to prevent it from happening. And in losing him, we lost that opportunity. That's his thesis. Okay, I'll accept the premise, but it is artificial. The truth is probably more complicated. And we may still have been in Vietnam had he dodged that bullet.
Yeah, it is interesting to see the way the film frames itself around Vietnam, discussing it at the beginning, and then how we were in Nam. It was signed just a few days after Kennedy died, as this film tells it.
Yeah, I feel like the thesis is good. I wanted to celebrate that if you're trying to say the warmongers are behind it all, here's who killed Kennedy, now I'm going to elaborate with several more pages of details and citations, but this is, you could stop the movie here. I just want to throw out another narrative, if you will, using movies now playing has watched. I do think there's another way of just kind of looking at this story that looks at it from my perspective. I'll put it that way. Godfather 2. Let's go back to that. As we recall in Godfather 2, everything was going well for the mobsters until Castro took over New Year's Day 1959, and all their Havana casinos were shuttered, and they were kicked off the island, and they wanted a guy in government to go back and kick some ass. And if you remember The Irishman, one of those mobster people was Jimmy Hoffa, who was responsible for the unions and organized labor, which meant that he was kind of a Democrat. And so, as it turns out, they decided Kennedy was their man. They could have gone with Nixon. He partied in their casinos in the 50s, but they ultimately said, let's send that guy Frank Sinatra over and have him wine and dine Jack, raise the money, rig the election in Chicago. Don't forget that famous story about the dead people voting, rigged elections. It happened. Kennedy's narrow election is owed to the mob. They got him into the White House when it probably should have been Nixon's. Had they not put their thumb on the scale, we would not have had him as the 35th president.
You mean it wasn't all because Nixon sweated during the debate that he lost?
I hear that story a lot.
Yeah, and I went back and watched all of that, and it was a poor performance. But keep in mind, a lot of people didn't have TVs. A lot of people heard the radio and said, oh, Nixon won that.
Yeah, those who heard the radio thought Nixon won.
Yeah, so exactly. It was all perception. But again, so narrow a victory, you got to credit the mob on this one. And then what does Frankie do? He starts taking Jack to Vegas, whining, dining him, introducing him to Marilyn Monroe. He makes Manchurian Candidate, which condemns both Republicans and communists. And meanwhile, unbeknownst to Jack, while he's doing all of this, the mob continues to plot to invade Cuba with the CIA. They're going forward on that. And this is historical fact. I'm not just alleging these things. We know these things now. And when Bobby Kennedy finds out about this, summer 1962, he pulls the plug, he fires a bunch of people, Frankie stops being JFK's best friend, Marilyn Monroe ends up dead in a hotel room that allegedly had papers in it that told of the love affair with JFK that would have embarrassed him, maybe caused him to step down. Sinatra almost whacked. Some of this is speculation, but a lot of this has been verified sources.
Yeah, I'm worried you're going to start getting into the Clinton death count next.
No, no, no. But what does Bobby do to come back on this? October 1963, he starts putting mobsters on television, ratting out the five families. If you remember, he had a very public attempt to crush crime. That was all in Godfather and some of those mob movies we watched with Pacino. Valachi was naming the five families. 1 month later, we have Jack Ruby, one of those mobsters, seen at various sites during the day of the assassination. I think it's really, really hard to minimize the mob. I think while I'm willing to go with Stone's perception of the industrial complex, I actually feel like the whole thing feels like a mob whack. And I feel like it suits Stone to think that it went higher than it did.
I agree that the mafia feels, especially because of the Bay of Pigs stuff, like it was very married to portions of our executive branch of government. But I also think Kevin Costner raises some good questions. Can the mafia tell the military to stand down that day?
Well, it's hard to distinguish between them. If they were all working together, if you have Cuban exiles working with CIA, working with mobsters, and they all feel jilted, then maybe they all did it. To me, the thing looks like a mob hit. Personally, that's just where I land on this. So I'm willing to grant Oliver Stone some of this, but I roll my eyes when he starts looking particularly at LBJ. I really kind of resent the fact that he implies the 36th president was in on it in some way.
Oh, yeah, that ending in this, yeah, when he accuses LBJ, oof, oh boy.
I don't like it, but because I don't agree with him politically doesn't mean I'm not going to enjoy this movie or at least appreciate that he's presenting this information.
The way he presents it, though, I mean, you mentioned The Godfather 2, and I almost thought you were going to have a totally different analogy of maybe telling us what's going on with Jim Garrison, and then having flashbacks to actually showing it happening or something. You know, the way we had the flashbacks to Robert De Niro in Godfather 2. Because it feels to me like Oliver Stone is out here and he's like, I'm going to make my version of All the President's Men. And it's going to have a deep throat character, and it's going to have all of these interrogations and investigations and personal costs to the investigators' lives, and end with a big revelation. And to me, the way the movie is, there are so many characters mentioned and everything is talked about. Every once in a while, you'll get a black and white snippet as if it was from footage at the time. But honestly, I only watched it once for this review because I ran out of time. I would have watched it again. But honestly, Stuart, you read the books. Maybe the answer is yes for you. But Jacob, did you follow all the layers of this conspiracy and exactly how the private investigator pistol whipping Jack Lemmon tied to Tommy Lee Jones in a bad wig?
I don't know. I think so a little bit. If you really press me, I'll probably have some holes in what I remember. But there's a lot of names in this. A lot of strings, again, being crossed and attached and pointing all over the place. So, yeah, I get it. It could be confusing. The thing is, I think I followed, again, this is my first time really watching it and paying attention. I was able to follow probably 80% of it. Like, when they'd say a name, I'm like, oh, okay, I remember that person getting mentioned before. Like, when Jack Lemmon comes back later in the film, I'm like, okay, I remember he got beat up. And so, I mostly was able to follow it.
Yeah, Arnie, I don't believe Oliver Stone is laying out this is how it happened.
You don't?
No, I'm sure of it. I know for a fact he doesn't believe that he's told you who did it. What he has done is created a montage of inference. I know a lot of people that have a lot to say about what happened that day, and it's not in the official report. Starting with this scene of this woman thrown out of the car.
What was this? This did confuse me. I had no idea who this was. And then she gets mentioned like 2 hours later.
Yeah, Rose Cherimay is one of the documented witnesses that is part of the conspiracy. She is in the Crossfire book. She is not in Garrison's book. And that is because she has no tie to that plot. There is nothing about her story that connects, other than through inference, to the people that are going to be prosecuted by Garrison. Rose Cherimay claims that she was with drug dealers coming from Florida to Dallas. They were doing a drug deal, and they knew Kennedy was going to be killed. And she, because she did drugs, got thrown out along the way. I don't believe it was as dramatic as this movie shows, but she was left behind, nowhere near New Orleans, by the way. And basically, she's famous because 2 days before JFK died, she told a cop, they're going to kill Kennedy. And he thought nothing of it. Until, you know, November 22nd, it's like, well, let's go back and talk to her. What did she know? And yes, she did end up getting run over and can't tell us much more.
Yeah, but I try to look at human psychology. Like, every time the president comes in, is there some wacko that calls the police? I know about an assassination plot. Like, this probably happens all the time. And that's why it's hard for me to buy into, if you know, psychology of eyewitnesses. Eyewitnesses are actually very unreliable.
Right.
the way this evidence is presented, the way this film comes across to me is like, here's all these things, like you add it up, and but we're only getting one side of the story. We're only getting Stone's side, which I guess that's what Stone is known for.
I wouldn't say this is Stone's version. I would say that Stone is adapting Crossfire.
I'm saying we're getting his side. He's not, you know what? You know what happened to JFK's brain? It didn't disappear. His brother took it because he didn't want to put it on display. Like, you're not going to be told that. Now, maybe they didn't know that at the time when this movie's taking place, but we're getting, I feel like, a very one-sided argument here. Even if it is like, here's all this evidence. I don't believe in all of it, but you guys sort it out. We don't see a counter argument.
No, even if it isn't Stone's personal point of view, it's presented as this film's point of view, and Stone wrote and directed this film. And so, therefore, when I say Stone's point of view, I mean the movie's point of view, and it is very one-sided. I imagine that Stone could make the exact same film, but focus completely on the Warren Commission and show us how the Warren Commission gathered its evidence that is 100% certain that it was Oswald, just Oswald, and only Oswald, and leave it at the same amount of certainty.
Yeah, as far as point of view, if you're talking about the idea that it was a conspiracy, multiple gunmen is what we're talking about. Yes, all the facts that are presented support that viewpoint, but they come from different theories. Rose Cheremay would indicate, because she says, I work for Jack Ruby, that it has a lot more to do with the mob than it does with the CIA, the alleged CIA gay people in New Orleans, which Garrison's case, ooh, boy, does it fall down in the light of inspection. But we'll get there.
Yeah, can we talk about who is Jim Garrison? Because, again, I didn't know a lot of these names when I watched it. And so I did a lot of Googling after this film, like looking up facts and how things actually turned out. But can we start with Garrison?
Yeah, I didn't even know he was a real person the first time I saw this film. I thought this was a fictional story telling of a conspiracy theory. But
you are correct. This is Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird trying to solve the Kennedy assassination. It has no bearing whatsoever on a man named Jim Garrison, who was district attorney of New Orleans. He is Kevin Costner. And I mean, I do feel like when we get his introductory scene and he's like, God, I'm ashamed to be an American today. I'm like, no, you ought to be ashamed to be Jim Garrison. Because, man,
he ought to be ashamed of that accent.
The New Orleans is not good, but it's better than his English Robin Hood accent.
He didn't do an accent for Robin Hood.
He did for like a couple scenes, and then he gave up.
The worst accent I ever saw him do was actually this week. He made another Kennedy movie called 13 Days about the Cuban Missile Crisis. His Boston is just oof.
Oh, I've seen that.
I've seen that one, yeah.
Yeah, that one is a little hard. It's a little hard.
Yeah, he's not known for that, right? Like, you hire Kevin Costner because he has this pretty boy, baseball, all-American Norman Rockwell persona. It comes from not just one movie, but his whole body of work is really that of, I'm nobility. I champion the right causes, and people believe in me because I'm decent and family. Jim Garrison, say what you will about him, he is not a family man. He has a lot of scandals in his closet. He is known to have collaborated with the mob. There is a child molestation charge against him. I won't dispute whether it's true or not, but there are methods that he behaves in and things that he does that are reasons to not support him being the district attorney.
And the end credits of this tell me he became judge a few times.
Well, again, they make that sound like a big deal. He did not get reelected. He was thrown out, scandalized. He went to a small, I mean, what he did was small time. And I think he wrote his book as a way to talk up himself and shout down some of his critics. Again, if your position is, well, everything said about me is a lie because they're out to get me, Jim Garrison is known as a paranoid. Here's where I would say judge him. Don't judge him on what has been alleged about his character. I'll avoid all of that stuff, although it's out there. Judge him on how he conducts this case. And I will tell you where the movie differs and what he actually did with some of these witnesses. By the way, this could have been Harrison Ford or Mel Gibson. There were other people that were in the mix, but Stone really thought Costner represented something.
I would agree with that, although Ford would work as well. Ford sometimes can have a darker side, which might actually have helped this character a little bit, because you're right, when you say Atticus Finch, I don't feel like Jim Garrison has dimension as a character. He is here to walk us through events.
You are 100% correct, Arnie, and that was one of my frustrations with this film, is it's not a drama. Like, I wrote down 90 minutes until we finally get some real drama, what it means to be obsessed with these conspiracies and how it's affecting his family. He's missing out on Easter brunch. And then like 2 hours, 10 minutes later, you get some more family drama. And then that's about it. Like, if you're looking to see what getting into this kind of thinking gets you, this is not the film. This is a lecture, not a dramatic film.
Yeah, poor Sissy Spacek has to be the little woman at home that just doesn't understand how important this case is. And she is positioned always to be like, oh, you're wasting your time. Care about your family. Care about suburbia. Don't think about that old news that important people have already investigated and shown what happened. So, yeah, she's going to be contemptible in Oliver Stone's mind. And it will take a long time to convince her that she is shallow and naive for wanting to only look at her family and not think about America. But incidentally, Jim Garrison divorced from this wife and she has nothing to do with him. And it has nothing to do with his position on who killed JFK. It has everything to do with his philandering and womanizing. And Stone even alleges, well, there's one scene in this movie where he kind of flirts with a black woman and they sing, "You're the cream in my coffee." That was Stone's attempt to try and say, yeah, this guy does step out.
Am I the only one who at one point when Sissy Spacek is lecturing Kevin Costner about going off this ledge, just once, couldn't she say they're all going to laugh at you? I mean, really?
Yeah. My hope was that they were going to dump pig's blood on her at the trial and then she would like fry them all. But that we're robbed. Not even the director's cut has a scene that good. But all right, so let's get in the case. That is who this man is. He is wholesome, ideal man, a sense of purity, investigating the evil corruption of New Orleans. That will start with, why not Joe Pesci? I mean, they've kind of pulled him out of a hat, and I've watched this movie twice now, and I do not know why they come to the idea that Dave Ferry is someone that knew Oswald.
Or how did they come up with the idea that Dave Ferry looked like this? I looked him up. Like, he does not have crazy eyebrows, this crazy wig that Pesci's wearing. Like, doesn't look like this. It was so just outlandish how they made him up.
Oliver Stone, I think there's been no movie we've talked about where we haven't commented that he always pushes it. You know, he always is, I'm going to ladle on anything heavy. Like, I don't do subtlety. Like, if this guy's supposed to be a creep, I'm going to make him super creepy here. The character did have alopecia. He couldn't have body hair. But yes, he doesn't look like this gargoyle that's running around doing Joe Pesci monologues.
All they really say is that he was a first-rate pilot and Oswald flew with him and they knew each other well. That is just the only thing that's dropped. But it doesn't really talk about them hanging out at gay parties together or anything like we're going to see.
I never knew the CIA was so gay friendly. Like, all their contacts are these homosexuals. And did the homosexual community like come out against this? Because like every gay character here is bad.
Oh, GLAAD heavily protested. Yeah, Gay Lesbians Against Defamation was very against this movie. And I think has a very good point. Because when you see, this looks like a case of gay bashing to me. It really does look like Jim Garrison went after a guy because he was vulnerable and he could expose him in the press. Dave Ferry, they're going to make it seem like he is killed by them, but in fact, he died of a heart attack because of the scandals that Jim Garrison happily ladled on him. Here's all that we know about him and Oswald. They served together 10 years before in the same flight troop. But since that time, no contact. We're talking about they were in a picture together with lots of other airboys. And Dave Ferry, yes, was a homosexual. And yes, he does seem to have hung out with Clay Shaw. Maybe. The photos even on that are not totally clear. But it will look nothing like the 18th century Whig party and painted up like Hermes and all of the extravagance.
Oh, I remember my uncles being outraged at this gay orgy scene that lasts all but like a minute. Like, it wasn't that big of a deal.
Well, look at what they're doing. Wholesome family versus decadent gay life. That's what they're really trying to sell here. Who are you going to side with? Who looks like America to you? It's got to be Jim Garrison because these people, So yeah, there's just a lot of inference. It's death by inference here. It's worth pointing out, they call Dave Ferry in. They say, you took off the afternoon of the murder. Yeah, it has been historically proven. He went to Houston and he did go ice skating. They even dragged the owner of the ice skating rink.
That's such a weird place to go ice skating. It's Texas. It's not known for its ice and snow.
But Houston is nowhere near Dallas, first and foremost. And second, they actually, Jim Garrison himself, dragged the owner of the ice skating rink into the trial so that he could go, yeah, I can account for where he was. And it was nowhere near any of this shenanigans in Dallas. Pointless. But this is what they're building on. The idea that this strange little homosexual went to Texas the afternoon and maybe was going to fly Oswald back to New Orleans because he can fly when he's not being accused of having sex with 14-year-old boys.
Yeah, this is one of the areas where I didn't really tie Ferry to the next people we're going to meet with, and then Ferry starts coming back later on. But, you know, Pesci is Pesci. He is big in this, but I expect nothing less. I'm able to follow this story better by keeping track of the actors in
it.
But I did remember Ferry in this one was Pesci.
And I did like Pesci's performance when the story finally gets out in the news and he's like, I'm a dead man. And again, because I want to see the paranoia of getting into this kind of thinking and the danger. And so I thought that was a good scene by Pesci. Like, I got some problems with this movie, but I do want to compliment a lot of the acting I thought was really good.
Yeah. The historical theory gave them everything. They never had enough. And he was, I believe, driven into the grave by the way that they exposed him in the press for being gay.
He didn't have a bottle of uppers next to him that could have given someone with hypertension a heart attack?
I mean, I could go into the details, but all of that. There was no suicide note, or what they pulled out and called a suicide note was just something that he wrote taken out of context. It was horrible the way that they treated him.
In this movie or in real life?
In real life. And in this movie, well, again, you have to believe that, okay, he's a suspicious character, but the FBI is going to vouch for him. They clear him and the Warren Commission is going to make it all fine. And so Jim Garrison feels like he can stand down. All right, the authorities are stepping in. I'll go work on other things. Keep in mind, he didn't even get involved for years. So like the idea that the weekend this was going on, he was digging into the connections. None of this is true.
Yeah, that seemed like a long shot that the murders in Dallas, so the DA of New Orleans, who presumably has other things to work on, was instantly going to drop everything to investigate the New Orleans connection to the Dallas shooting. That really seemed unbelievable.
Yeah, I didn't really understand why Garrison does decide to get involved. 3 years later, we have a jump and he's on a plane with Senator Long, who says, you know, there's holes in this Warren Commission. And so Garrison just decides to get back into it.
I think the Warren Report is something every American felt they needed to buy and then didn't read. My dad had
all 26 volumes.
He didn't have the 26 volume. They made some pocket size that condensed all the best stuff into one. But I don't even think he read that because it's dense. It's legalese. Who wants to sift through all of that stuff? So I feel like what they're trying to say is a lot of people knew that an official version existed, but they didn't look into it. And Stone is asking us to look into it now. He's not trying to tell you what to think or which theory to believe, but just look at what's in this report and tell me if this sounds like it holds. Yeah, Walter Matthau is our first voice of dissent. That dog don't hunt. And then Garrison spends all night reading and ignoring his wife and says, I gotta jump in on this.
And again, New Orleans just seems like such a weird jurisdiction in which to try regarding the murder of a president. Dallas, Texas, Washington, D.C., all of these make more sense to me.
Well, it is true. One thing that is undisputed is that Oswald was born in New Orleans and did spend the entire summer doing things that are weird before he moved back to Dallas in 63.
Yeah, I'm a little confused and wondering where this is going when Garrison takes up and starts investigating this whole thing. He has Brizard, played by Michael Rooker, and Bertel, played by Wayne Knight, and they go to Bannister's place. We saw him, you know, reacting to the JFK assassination. He was happy about it. He's beating up Jack Lemmon for reasons, but now he's dead, and I'm like, why are we starting here? This seems like a weird place to start.
And isn't it sad they had Walter Matthau? Why couldn't we have that Odd Couple reunion that I really wanted? Instead, they get Ed Asner from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, totally fucking with my, like, sitcom understanding of these actors. I'm like, wait, they don't work together. But yes. So here's what we need to know about Bannister. He is ex-FBI from Chicago, read that as mob, who came down here to open a detective agency. This is not disputed. That detective agency did live around the corner from a place where radical communists did print out leaflets and did go out in the streets. And one of those was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Around the corner, was it the same exact building?
Yes. Yeah, all of that is not disputed. And so the idea is, even though Oswald is positioned to look like a pro-communist Marxist, He, in fact, many will tell you, I actually believe it too, he was a CIA agent. And he, from a very early age, was recruited and was working for maybe Bannister or other people in the CIA. And that sets up the idea that he could have been manipulated, could have been a patsy.
Yeah, we learned that Bannister ran these training camps for militias to, you know, do, again, these secret black ops missions.
And that is not substantiated, but we do know that the CIA was very interested in trying to get back, using the mob, frankly, and ex-Cuban exiles. They were really thinking about training people to reinvade Cuba, have Bay of Pigs too. So they're saying that Ed Asner was somehow behind that. Allegedly.
Yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but I'm just describing what Stone has shown me in this film.
Right, yes. So Bannister is running that with Dave Ferry, Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci and Ed Asner have a camp where you can learn how to kill Castro, and they need money, so they're getting it from some clay someone. Like, that's all that Jack Lemmon can really tell you. He's another detective working for Bannister, and so he's also a drunk and has been known to tell lots of lies throughout his career, but...
And again, Bannister is dead by this point.
Yes. So, again, anytime someone dies, that's more inference of foul play, right? They couldn't have just died of natural causes. They got to him. They were covering it up.
Yeah, what I thought was weird, before we had this 3-year jump, we have the scene with Bannister and Martin, Jack Lemmon's character, where they go to his office and it looks like someone's broken in and gone through his files, and that's when he beats up Jack Lemmon. Like, that never came back. I was waiting for a big reveal of like, oh, these were the documents he had that were stolen. I don't know, maybe I missed it. There's a lot going on in this film, but that was something that I felt never came back. Like, what was that whole scene about?
Inference.
Okay, just inference.
What they're trying to say is that he had files on Operation Mongoose, which is something that has come to light that the CIA was running. It's a real thing. They were stockpiling arms. They were training Cubans. They were going to go back and get Castro. And then they worked. The CIA did have these plots about bringing in drugs to poison his cigar or make his beard fall out. A lot of these things. I want to compliment Stone. It sounds crazy because he's throwing them all out at the wall. And you might think, does he believe all this stuff? I don't think he believes all this stuff. He is citing sources that have some level of verification. He is going through historical anomalies that exist in the Crossfire book and have dogged the single gunman theory. And so that's all I feel like he's doing. Anything that can be brought up to raise suspicion about Oswald being the one and only source of the crime, that's what he's going to put in this film. Whether they all marry together and form a cohesive picture, that I don't believe Stone is trying to do.
Yeah, because trying to follow this through line, and did Jack Lemmon actually take the files that he was pistol whipped for, or was he just taking the liquor in the file cabinet? And
no, Jack Lemmon is playing a known drunk private eye that didn't probably know anything. What he's alleging was that he saw his boss hanging out with some Cubans and maybe Dave Ferry. And that's all he knows. That's all he can give them. But watch out, because people at the racetrack are watching and they'll whack him too. And again, Stone is good at creating the paranoia. Even when these leads feel rather innocuous, like who cares? Okay. They're going to make it seem like it's life or death.
Yeah, we're going to meet, and I don't know if this is the greatest New Orleans accent ever or so bad it is the greatest thing ever, but John Candy as this lawyer, Dean, who was hired by Clay something for Oswald. Like, what is Candy doing here? Like, I don't know if this is amazing or just so bad it's amazing.
It's actually pretty good. He's nailing the guy pretty well. The guy...
Is he? Okay.
Oh, yeah. The daddy-o, he talked about them cats... And he couldn't get any job. He was a lawyer and didn't understand while talking to this. He couldn't get any work. Here's the real story on Dean Andrews. Dean Andrews hears that JFK has been assassinated and says, I want to represent Oswald. How do I get in on that? Keep in mind, he had pneumonia and was taking drugs, so this is impaired thinking. But he starts calling everyone he knows and bragging that he's going to represent Oswald.
Okay, this is real life, because in the movie, it feels like he didn't want anything to do with Oswald.
Oh, yeah, no, this bullshit movie we can talk about in a second. I'm telling you what has been documented about Dean Andrews. He was lying and bragging and said, I'm going to represent Oswald. Bang. Jack Ruby takes out Oswald and he goes, oh. And then people start asking, well, who hired you to do that? Who did that? He makes up a name. He goes, Clay Bertrand, pulls it out of his ass. There is no one that has ever been named Clay Bertrand. This movie will allege that that's some nefarious alias for Tommy Lee Jones.
What? Oh, this movie's bullshit.
Bullshit. This is a liar who tried to brag his way onto the case and then made up a name and had to go all the way to the trial and get 3 counts of perjury against him for not saying who Clay Bertrand really was when he was screaming, "Oh my God, I just made him up. Please ignore this." Garrison wouldn't. He assumed that Dean was protecting Clay Bertrand. So Oliver Stone has to make that story play as some part of this conspiracy. And that is just a shame when you realize how much of this scene is just total bullshit.
Well, I'm glad John Candy's in here doing what he's doing. It was entertaining, at least.
Yeah, he's totally entertaining. And maybe one of his last roles, too. I don't remember seeing him too much after 1991.
Wagons East was the last, so...
I don't think anyone saw Wagons East.
And those things sat on shelves. He did a movie with Michael Moore, too, that was awful.
Yeah, Canadian Bacon.
Yeah.
I believe it was Canadian Bacon he was filming when he died. But yeah, this was near the end.
So again, this is the case that Garrison is building. I got some lawyer friend who made up a name called Clay Bertrand, and we found out from sources that this Joe Pesci guy may have known Oswald and went to Houston, which is in Texas, where Dallas is.
It's very far away from Dallas, though.
I mean, this is the case that they're building.
Yeah, it's not convincing me.
And again, because it's so tenuous, the first hour of this, when they're going to Joe Pesci and Jack Lemmon and even John Candy, I'm following along completely. But in the second hour, around the time we get to the death of Bobby Kennedy and things, and Kevin Bacon in jail, I'm hanging on by my fingernails. I'm keeping track of main threads, but there's a lot of people around that I'm like, why?
Yeah, Kevin Bacon, Willie O'Keefe, that's the next thread. He knows about Bertrand, even though that's, I guess in this film, that was an actual alias that Shaw is going to use. That's why he would know that name.
Yes. In this film, we have to accept the idea that Clay Shaw is a big established, presumably straight person that when he goes gay, calls himself Clay Bertrand.
Not with that hairdo.
Yeah, because he's so butch. We'll have Kevin Bacon here explain he's really butch. I'm like, the guy's like pinky waving at people.
Yes.
Like, there's nothing butch about what Tommy Lee Jones is doing. He's doing some kind of 18th century drag thing. But we're to believe that nobody in society knows that these two are the same, that he has a down-low persona. And Willie O'Keefe is, wow, this one's a real humdinger. Okay, not a real person. Largely based on this guy that, known to have mental illness, was an insurance agent from somewhere who was friends with Dave Ferry, who knew nothing about Clay Bertrand or Clay Shaw, but kind of got himself on the case. And Garrison said, "I know the best way to get you to tell the truth. I'm going to inject you with sodium pentothal, hypnotize you, and then talk to you a lot about Clay Shaw and Clay Bertrand."
I feel like Garrison is a secret agent for the government to confuse everyone with what happened with JFK with these tactics.
And if you think that that sounds crazy, the real Garrison said, "I only did that once." They're saying I did that 3 times. Regardless of the fact, we can go back to the documents and know that this character never connected Tommy Lee Jones to Dave Ferry. But in this movie, Kevin Bacon was a rent boy who always hung out at the parties and saw everybody hanging out and having a good old time. And it's very entertaining. I want to say, inside the context of the movie, the first time I rewatched this movie a few days ago, I'm really amused by these scenes. These characters are colorful in the way of like Midnight of the Garden of Good and Evil, like these Southern Gothic, like crazy types. It's working as perverse comedy for me to see all of these sordid types milling about New Orleans. It's kind of a funny documentary about that town and the eccentrics that can be popular there. What I'm never getting, and that's because it really can't be done, is a connection when Stone wants to go back to Dallas. Like, this movie feels entirely separate from what happened to JFK.
Yeah, I agree. If this was a YouTube series where, you know, here's this character and here's that character, like, they are fun on their own. It's when you're trying to mash it all together and make it work together. That's when I start having problems. But again, I think so many performances are wonderful. You talk about the editing, how they're flashing back as they're talking and telling these stories. I can see why this one editing. I'm not sure about cinematography because it's just people sitting around in rooms most of the time. Like, is it really that hard to light? But I get it for editing. Like, it's going to Natural Born Killers, just that multimedia thing where we're just going to jump all over the place and make it like a music video. It keeps me interested.
One of the things about Natural Born Killers that I remember and that came back to me watching this was the heavy top light, especially when they were in the prison, but a lot of cases. And they do that here. Anytime they're speaking to somebody, it's like there's a huge light just right above their head. Anybody who's bald, it's bright white. Anybody's hair is just looks like it's on fire. There was a lot of that going on, trying to keep it visually interesting. And Jacob, I wish I could agree with you that there were great performances, because it is edited in such a way that other than a handful of characters, mostly on Garrison's team, Kevin Costner and Michael Rooker specifically, I'm not able to judge a performance because people are there and gone. Kevin Bacon gives a nice little monologue as a prisoner that we see once. This is a film of cameos.
It's like movie 43, right?
Yes. Is that a bad thing necessarily, though? I mean, I think there are many movies where I can think somebody came on, had one scene, and stole the show.
No, look, I love the Muppet movie, and that's what that is. Like, a bunch of 70s comedians and TV stars, like, making cameos and telling a joke and then exiting left.
But did any one of them here steal the movie, Stuart? Is there one cameo you think of and think, wow, that guy was great in JFK?
I gotta say, I love Bacon. They got him out there, and he's, of course, you know, trying to do his best to tie everyone in the same room. Oh, yeah, Oswald was there, and Clay was there, and Fairy was there, and I saw it all going on. But then he's like, well, why are you telling us this? This is, like, the best part of the scene. And he's like, well, you know, JFK, he's a communist. Like, that whole monologue, the idea that JFK promised too much to the blacks and robbed America of a great president like Nixon.
Apparently, homosexuals were really into Nixon at the time, according to this film.
Yeah, I don't think that that was the common position of gay people at that time, but that was a surprise that made me smile, that someone would have that agenda and it would come across in this way was just a killer scene. I think it's just a funny moment. The New Orleans stuff works to me as dark comedy. The Dallas stuff is where I get sucked into Who Killed JFK. And they're two different movies. They're two distinct styles and worlds that they try to blend, but not too hard. Because I think, I'll just put it out there, I think Stone knows that this case is a sham. I actually think that you could say that he had to go with this, because this is the only case that was ever brought out against anyone for killing JFK. There's no other court case to go to. If you're going to hang a courtroom drama on who killed JFK, you either make up everyone and it has no bearing on history, or you go with Garrison. And he says he knew that Garrison went down some wrong alleys and cavorted with some freaks and what have you. But the essence of what he was chasing, translation, but I can spin this in a way that makes him the embodiment of truth. And I think that to Oliver Stone, he isn't a character. As you said, he is a blank slate that I can write all of my essays and speeches upon. Which is fine as long as you don't pay attention to the historical Garrison.
Yeah, but he's also starting this film like, we can't be silent. Those are cowards. We must speak up. Like, it's a sin to not talk about this. Oh, it's mostly made up, but it's a sin to not talk about it. Like, that is the problem I have.
Again, I think if this movie could find a way not to be in New Orleans, it would be on such better footing as a docudrama. But he didn't want to make a documentary. I mean, he said that. I'm not here to make a documentary. I'm not going to just tell it from a fictional perspective about the gunmen or Oswald or all of that would require too much fiction. I want to stick to what is known about the case. And so this was the only thing that offered an acceptable three-act structure for him. Garrison's prosecution when everyone was calling him crazy.
I wish there was more focus on Garrison being called crazy. I find what you're telling me about Garrison's life to be a better drama than what I'm seeing here. Because what I'm seeing here is somebody connect the dots, again, between cameo performances and trying to convince me, or at least trying to tell me, what they think really happened versus what the Warren report said. But what I'm missing here is personal drama. I'm missing it greatly. We're not getting it on the behalf of Tommy Lee Jones's character, who's being possibly wrongly accused, who is outed because of these investigations. We get one scene at Garrison's house with the wife saying she's leaving him, but then she doesn't. So I'm missing character drama. There's no character for me to hang on to here. I'm just watching a completely noble man, Kevin Costner, walked off the Untouchables and onto here and is taking me through another investigation.
There are details. Again, he'll have asides to the maid, and there are many scenes with the wife. I mean, it's not, they have one big dramatic moment. They try to make the team sort of represent the different voices. He's got these two guys, one of which Michael Rooker sort of represents the Warren report perspective. Like, he's got family in the FBI. He doesn't like the inference. As they get closer and closer to the idea that it had to be an inside job, you see him pull back from that, and it will look like he quits in the theatrical version. The director's cut, that's a big scene. He has a storyline that isn't included in the theatrical cut that shows his betrayal with the FBI. Meanwhile, you got the other guy, the chief investigator, Lou, who is going to walk away also for other reasons. Again, they try to do their best to represent the idea that there is disagreement within the group as they gather the information.
I will disagree with that. I think, yes, there is a scene with Rooker that calls that out. I don't know how much of that is tied to the director's cut, but I don't feel like there's a lot of questioning Garrison in this. Again, it's go along with them. Again, we'll get that one scene with Rooker. My big problem here is this isn't a drama. This is a lecture. And, you know, the last film Sean had us review, The House That Jack Built, that was part of my problem with that film. It felt more like a lecture about art and aesthetics than an actual movie.
So I hear what you're saying. In general, because it has to condense all of the volumes of conspiratorial knowledge that it has, it will go long because it has to get through all of that stuff, or because it wants to go through all that stuff. It's important to the movie. It's why we're here, is to learn tidbits and trivia and things that make us go, I can't agree that there's no characters here. I do feel it's functionality. They're not like elaborate characters, but I do see people changing alliances. I do see warm human moments. Again, some of the worst scenes when Kevin Costner has to comfort his kids on the swing. And
oh, that was painful.
It's bad.
Yeah. I mean, they're not always the best scenes, but there are almost in every scene, you see the actors trying to work in a shading or a detail that will make them people you want to follow. And again, I think Costner had that. He didn't have to work that hard for it because he was coming off of Dances with Wolves, Bull Durham, Field of Dreams. Robin Hood was a big hit. I don't know why. So he had the goodwill of the audience that they would go with him on anything. And so they're just happy to go with him, I think. I think that Stone is using that star power and appeal to cover for some of what you guys are asking for, which is more character shading.
Yeah, and just more of a narrative. If you want to do this, just make it a docudrama. You're right. Like, make this a documentary. There's not a narrative here.
Yeah, there kind of is in the investigation. You know, again, I go back to All the President's Men. And I feel that some of these sins are done in that movie as well.
I mean, when we get to Shaw's trial, we know that's bullshit. We know that's going to go bad. Like, I didn't remember how this movie turned out, but as soon as that trial started, I'm like, well, he's going
to
walk.
The point of the trial isn't even the trial. The point of the trial is to give Kevin Costner a chance to talk to the movie's audience.
Do a 30-minute monologue, yeah.
I went to a religious movie once. I was tricked into going by a friend. And at the end, a pastor showed up and like started speaking right to the audience and said, come to the front of the theater and feel God's love. And it was around 1991 that this happened. And I got to say, Costner at the end of this reminded me of that revival.
You're hanging on his closing argument, which is 10 minutes long. And I get it. But I don't feel like the movie is 3 hours of him doing that. I actually feel there is a dramatic structure. He starts out as somebody who, I mean, he's always got the same expression. He's always kind of looking like, well, I'm not sure about this, but I'll believe the TV that this Oswald is the guy and I'll go along with it. And then he starts reading the Warren Report. And then Act Two is really about looking at all of the fallacies of that document. We have, I think they really start by looking at Oswald himself, which is a fascinating history. I share his enthusiasm at looking at that narrative. The director's cut goes into more detail. I think this is where the director's cut is better because you spend more time with Gary Oldman and what he was doing throughout his life. I think the case that Oswald is a patsy really is strengthened once they start looking at his personal history. It's the stuff that convinced me that he was CIA. When we get to, it's really given to Laurie Metcalf. She's the one that has gone back, looked at his whole history. It's longer in the director's cut, but I mean, I find all of this stuff fascinating that he defected to the Soviet Union and then came back.
And got married over there? I didn't realize that, I guess.
Yes.
And here's the thing, Stuart. I agree. This is all interesting, but Stone is telling me to be a critical thinker and question things. And here, again, Laurie Metcalf, it is just word vomit. I'm looking for evidence, and this is just a lot of words. I don't know. Maybe the point is I'm supposed to go home and wiki and Google afterwards.
There you go.
Or the 1991 equivalents of those.
Yeah, he is doing this through the cinematic medium. You're going to experience the information as data dumps. You have to accept that, or you will not have a pleasant experience.
I mean, one moment is they're talking about that photo of Oswald. Was it photoshopped? Was it man-made? And we'll see someone making it. Dartmouth just proved, like, no, that's a real photo. Like, they did a 3D modeling because people question the angle he's standing at. Like, it defies physics. No, it doesn't. Like, but here they are going to portray, like, no, someone's cutting his head and putting it on someone else's body, holding that gun that was used to kill JFK.
It's very biasing in that regard. It doesn't allow you to make a determination. It's illustrating what they mean about the compositing of the photo, especially back in 1991, where people had never heard of Photoshop. But then people even today would be like, well, how do you do it without Photoshop? But by showing the cutout happen and showing Oswald say that's not real, and then having somebody say, look, the shadows don't match, it's leaving no room for interpretation in the mind of the audience.
And I do not think that this movie should do that. I agree that Stone is trying to make a case here. He's not trying to, like, you decide and all of, like, no, that's actually, you can go do that afterwards and look through all the things that I have. I'm here to tell you the way that it best amasses the case that something is rotten in Denmark. That is all that he's trying to do by bringing up at a constant rate that is harder than the brain can process, that there are many things that don't add up.
I think it's damaging, though, if you watch this film, you're like, oh yeah, it's a conspiracy. LBJ killed JFK. And then, oh no, that photo is real. Oh, Ferry, like, he was, like, mistreated and, like, that's all bullshit. It's going to have an effect on you saying, well, this whole movie's bullshit then. Like, he lied.
Right. I think that is ultimately the thing that I wrestle with this movie. But I just want to say, when I'm in this movie and watching it and absorbing these details, to me, it's masterful. To me, I feel like this is Stone at the height of his powers pulling me in. And it helps that I have a fascination with this case. I mean, if it were about some other moment in history that I was less involved with, I probably would be yawn. Can we get through this? But I do want to process all this information. I do think, particularly Oswald, the fact that he was able to come back without question. Can you imagine such a thing? Can you imagine defecting to a country, possibly giving away secrets that got a plane shot down, and then coming back with no complaint and living there unchallenged? You obviously have to be, I believe that is conclusive, he had some kind of connection to the CIA then.
How can I believe that, though, when it's presenting other evidence to me, like that photo, that isn't? This becomes non-informative. This movie is disinformation.
I think my problem is like, yeah, I think Oswald did have something to do with the CIA. I think the YouTube plane going down is coincidence. Like, they always just, Stone just pushes it a little too far, tries to connect too many dots where I'm like, nah, now this is not credible.
And again, I don't think Stone is saying it's all true. If it were, it would be everyone killed him, right? Like, the conclusion is everyone was in and all of America wanted this guy dead. Only he didn't know when he was rounding the corner he was going to get shot. I don't think the point is to say, here's the conclusive version of all that. This movie was described, I think, by Entertainment Weekly as the Citizen Kane of conspiracy theories. They are using all kinds of cinematic tricks, like Orson Welles did in Citizen Kane, to highlight all the different ways you could possibly see the assassination without settling on a version that goes beyond that, yes, it was more than one person.
I guess the difference is Citizen Kane was a hit job on Hearst, you know, the newspaper man, the billionaire, but it's shown as fictional. So you're not going to question the whole thing about Hearst later, like, because you're like, well, no, it's about Kane. He's naming names that are real people, and that's the problem. Typically, unless you're Tarantino and you're calling out, like, this is historical fiction, like Inglourious Bastard, like, it ruins your credibility for me.
I understand that fear, and if someone were presenting a thesis saying this all were true, it would be a mark against the paper that they cited bad sources. But I feel, again, why I'm not offended and can accept the idea that some of this is true and some of it is not, is that they've adapted all of Crossfire. They're not being selective about the conspiracy. They are highlighting all the possible angles.
Yeah, but they're putting it within a historical context that this real life person believed all of this, and here's all the evidence he found.
I feel like the thesis is screaming, I don't know who did it, but it was more than Oswald. And that's all he wants you to accept. That's the only thing he hopes to convince you of. It wasn't Oswald.
Except he's going to pin blame on a specific person whom he will take to trial. Yet that person seems less connected than half the other people he's investigated.
And again, that's why I see it as two different movies and a lesser movie, a vaudeville comedy when we go to New Orleans. But when we're in Dallas and we're running through the history and the next phase is, okay, that's Oswald. Then we got the eyewitnesses and you have all of this stuff. Again, some of this stuff has been, as you say, Jacob, like the hobos. Let's get to the hobos things.
I researched this a lot. I was fascinated by the hobos. I didn't know about this.
Yeah, they know who those hobos are now. And we brought up when we recorded Natural Born Killers that one of them is allegedly Woody Harrelson's dad. Why do we think this if they were never booked and we don't have them in a file? It's because Woody Harrelson's dad was a hitman and he was trying to drum up business. And so he would brag this. Who wouldn't want to hire the guy that killed Kennedy if you were trying to off somebody? So that he went around saying, I was one of those guys. They have now proven he was not. But he did kill a judge in, I think, San Antonio, and he got hired for that job because they thought he was one of the hobos. But yeah, they know who those hobos are, and scandal, they were hobos. The reason why they didn't go to jail is they paid their little fine.
Just very well-dressed hobos.
I think everyone was better dressed in the 60s,
yes.
Right? It just, everyone looked better back then.
Even the hobos could go to Men's Warehouse.
It's true. And so, yeah, some of the thing about the woman being thrown out and the guy in the train yard, that one irritates me because it makes it seem... They say he died in a car crash, but then we cut to black and white. And black and white is always trying to show you what isn't true. This movie is a montage of actual documentary footage and recreation. But when they cut to black and white, usually they're trying to show you the thing that hasn't been documented by cameras. Translation, pure speculation. And so when we find out that this guy died in a car accident, we don't see him in a car accident. We see him laying on his steering wheel with what looks like a bullet going through his windshield, like it's cracked, like he got shot. And so Stone is guilty of trying to infer more than what is historically known. He wants you to think that all these witnesses are being harassed and killed by the deep state. And in fact, there may or may not be reasons why they died in the 5 years in between the murder and this court case.
Another real life thing, the conspiracy theory of the Clinton death count, like if you just look up the facts, it makes sense. They know a lot of people and people die. It's not sinister murders. I would find a movie like this where you apply this real life psychology to be fascinating. Here, maybe at a time, I don't know what the popular opinion was in 1991 about the JFK assassination. It seems like this was a controversial film, so maybe this was a big point to make that it wasn't a single shooter.
I do think that conspiracy theory in general is more popular now than it was in 1991. And so it was radical that anyone could put these ideas in a major Hollywood film. I love the fact that Oliver Stone cast the real Jim Garrison, who was still alive at this time, to play Earl Warren. In the Earl Warren scene where he goes to talk to Jack Ruby in the jail cell, that's actually the Jim Garrison of real life being his nemesis.
I read that and I did pay attention to the way that was acted. And it was funny, just the snideness and the meanness.
I also think, you know, we've been talking about Wes Craven and The Nightmare on Elm Street, right? We talked about how he was referenced to things going on in the Manson family in the 60s and the 70s. That's got to be a JFK reference. Now that I've seen that he died on Elm Street, I'm like, oh, that is what he was going for.
I told you, I think I said this in our Nightmare on Elm Street podcast. My father heard I was really into A Nightmare on Elm Street and asked if he could watch it, thinking it was a JFK film.
I don't remember that, but I haven't listened to that show in a decade, but that's hilarious. Yeah, it clicked for me this time, hearing so much when they're up there trying to recreate the shots thing. And that's something that has been recreated, but it's really hard. I don't know where you guys stand on. I don't know anything about guns, so I don't have an opinion about whether somebody can get three shots off with that rifle in 5.6 seconds.
This was a single bolt action rifle, I believe. So you have to load that bullet every time, which would be hard to do in 5.6 seconds.
Yeah.
What they postulate here that really influences me towards thinking not Oswald is there's a long straight road just coming up a different street, not on Elm Street, where you could have taken a shot, had a clean shot for a very long time, instead of on that very short curve where it's a much harder shot and it could have been blocked by the trees. So if it was Oswald, why didn't he shoot initially at the first range?
Yeah.
Again, though, I think people involved in assassinations, John Hinckley doing it for Jodie Foster, like, they're not always the most, you know, well-rounded individuals.
If you can get those three shots off in the 6 seconds, if you are that adept at being a marksman and moving your gun like that, if you were at peak efficiency as a sniper at that moment, you would think of the best vantage point.
Okay, Occam's razor, if the CIA is behind this, the mafia, whoever, wouldn't they have figured that out? And wouldn't it be easier to have only one shooter instead of a whole team? That would be much easier to figure out. There's a lot more evidence the more people you have involved. To me, it's bad thinking. Like, these are not people that thought it through.
So you are a believer that Oswald pulled the trigger?
I believe he pulled one of the triggers, yeah.
Okay, I actually am going to go as far with the movie as saying he probably was sitting in the lunchroom. I actually think that he was waiting for CIA orders while they were setting him up.
And the fingerprints on the gun make it interesting that the FBI didn't find any, but then local Dallas PD did find a palm print.
Yeah, he had no gunpowder on him. He didn't fire that rifle. They found no trace evidence that he fired. Supposedly he killed a cop, and supposedly he killed JFK, and they found none of that on him the day of that brought him in. That, to me, is Slim Shady.
Forensics were not great back then. They were not what they are today.
That is exactly right. And we look at this from the perspective of there's DNA evidence. There's so many things we can do with the crime scene. But yeah, this thing had hundreds of people walking through it. We didn't have all of those tools. I think they were counting on confusion. I think that the conspiracy, you're saying, why would they wait? Why would they do it this way? They wanted to be sure they could hit him. I think that they set it up this way because they wanted to be sure that there were enough people in position that he was not getting out from Elm Street.
Right, but I'm saying that then leads away from the single gunman theory, that it makes it implausible that it would be a single gunman.
There have been commissions that came out since the Warren one where they said, yeah, there probably was a second shooter.
I mean, the magic bullet is the most ridiculous thing ever put forth by the government, and I've read some of the tax plans.
Yes, but they measured the path of the bullet from where the bullet holes in the clothes were. The clothes were not necessarily where the body parts were. I mean, there are holes in people that want to push that theory. Like, there are explanations for it.
It's also worth pointing out that, yes, we don't have all of the coroner reports. Things did go missing for reasons, whatever, benign or sinister. But it has come out that Gerald Ford did doctor certain things about the medical reports in the Warren report because they were told, don't start a war. The Warren Report did have an agenda, and that was, if you get anything near to the idea that we're going to have to retaliate, if you can find that Cuba and Castro did this, or Khrushchev did this, or Vietnam, somebody there, then don't bring that out. Because whatever we do, we want to make sure it doesn't require a response from the U.S. government.
And they interview some of the people that were down there watching it, and they talk about hearing shots from all sides, but that could be echo as well.
Yeah, eyewitness reports, bad. You're not expecting gunfire, so when gunfire breaks out, your mind tries to reconstruct the whole story. You weren't expecting that. You weren't watching for it. It's like a car accident. It might have been a red car, a brown car. It just happened all of a sudden. And then your mind tries to construct what it just saw. It wasn't expecting that. So eyewitness accounts, not very reliable.
Yeah, the Zapruder film is more important than what people think they saw. And that is, you know, I think an important document. I hadn't seen it before seeing this movie, only in this context.
You've never seen it?
No.
I remember in high school, we had a whole JFK assassination conspiracy theory, day or two lesson. And yeah, we watched this. I showed my girls this and like, I show them horror movies. Like they never get scared of them anymore. I showed them this. They're like, oh, dang.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Like
I saw it in high school as well, but it didn't look as graphic as it was here. It was watched on a small television in a classroom. They didn't zoom in on a portion of it just to show how big the chunk of head that flies out is and make it really gory. But this is the real Zapruder film that we're seeing in this movie.
Yeah, and I think it had to be. Again, many times you're seeing actual footage that was shot by people and they're like, that's the craftiness of Stone. And you could see that as either an asset as a propagandist. He's going to convince you more. And sometimes you're like, that's the real Oswald. No, that's Gary Oldman. No, that's Frank Whaley. And like they introduced the idea that there were multiple Oswalds because they have several different people playing Oswald. Is that unethical? I guess is the question. Should Stone feel more responsibility to say what he can comfortably know to be true, or does he have the freedom to allege and insinuate and just wing it and throw it up there?
He can do whatever he wants. I mean,
yeah, within the bounds of the law, like there's libel and stuff like that, but you can make whatever artistic statement you want. If you want people to believe that there's some conspiracy, though, I think it's damaging if you're going to just go out full Ministry of Propaganda here.
Yeah, and I don't mind him taking whatever stance, so long as the stance he takes is justifiable, able to be backed up in a reasonable manner, and told through the cinematic format. The biggest problem, though, is I went into JFK to watch a movie, and this thing is neither fish nor flesh. It feels almost like half of it would be a documentary recreation I'd see on the History Channel or something. Was it multiple shooters looking at the angle of the heads and having the expert witness discuss back and to the left and the way all of these hour to 2 hour long things that are on Netflix, on various cable channels do.
If it's the History Channel, you got to have the Aliens guy show up and give his theory.
Ooh, I saw some awful History Channel JFK stuff.
Yeah.
Just wretched.
But then you also have Kevin Costner and Michael Rooker supposedly in a movie. And here, I feel that Stone wants to make the History Channel thing, but feels like what he's getting $40 million to make is a Kevin Costner movie. And so is it working well in either way? It feels like it's trying to juggle too much and it's just off balance.
See, I think it's doing it exceptionally well, like really well. And I'm judging it purely on my feelings about being pulled into the mystery. How could a man so powerful be killed? Look at all the things they're bringing forward. I don't know anything about Garrison when I'm watching it 3 days ago. That's not in my way. That is only when I watch it again. When I have the uneducated experience, I feel like this movie's highly absorbing.
Yeah, I think there is something that draws you in. I have the mentality to just start questioning things as soon as something seems so one-sided. So that's a problem for me. But I could see someone getting sucked in by this. When we go to DC and meet Donald Sutherland's character, X, like I think this is a fascinating scene. I don't buy most of it, but again, the performances are great and it's just so fast talking and moving. I think you could get really sucked into this whole Operation Mongoose conspiracy.
This is where it screamed to me that Oliver Stone wanted to make All the President's Men. Was there a Deep Throat character talking to Jim throughout this, or was this just complete fiction that was there for the sake of trying to call back to a better movie with a more founded conspiracy?
Kind of both. I mean, there was a guy that did quit the administration. He's not in secret. His identity is well known. His views are well advertised. And so, yes, some of this stuff was being said and Garrison was aware of. I want to put it out there. Garrison wasn't on the cutting edge of this. There were so many articles and books already alleging the Warren Report was fiction. So it wasn't like he was the one man that was saying, everyone, you got to believe me, and no one wanted to hear it. there was a lot going on. Prouty was one of those guys. Here, he's Donald Sutherland, fictionalized.
I mean, was it a big scandal then when it came out that Garrison was investigating this as portrayed in this film with the press and, you know, where's this $8,000?
Well, yes, that was a big deal because he was taking taxpayer money to go all over the place and maybe gambling with it and maybe hanging out with the mob and who knows what else. Unethical things that are happening.
Not just investigating the assassination then, like this movie portrays.
But I also want to say the press knew about it the whole time because he invited Life magazine to follow him around the entire time. Life magazine stopped hanging with him when they thought he started sounding unhinged and crazy and saying things like Jack Ruby, Oswald, Clay Shaw, and David Ferry are all gay together and they're doing thrill kills like the guys in Alfred Hitchcock's Rope, and they killed JFK because he was handsome and they were just so jealous. I mean, maybe he was drunk, maybe he was high on power, but he scared away the press. If they turned on him, it was because he opened his mouth too much. He talked a big game and didn't have a lot to back it up with. So yeah, when you see things going on here, and again, it's only in the director's cut that you can see that he did go to the Johnny Carson show. Here it's John Larroquette. Johnny Carson in real life did have him on to poke fun at him. And he really did try to hold up photos of people that he was alleging were killers. And they were like, please put that down because that's libel lawsuits. That's true. You can't just do that on live television. It doesn't make it a conspiracy that Johnny Carson is in on. It just means that you have to be careful about what you say on television.
Wouldn't that be so much of a more interesting movie if this was a hard look at that person then and his descent into madness as he investigates JFK?
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
I would love for someone to remake this, take it away from the puritanical righteousness of Oliver Stone and have someone just make it look like a crazy Strangelovian characters that are just all absurd. I mean, it's a satire. Like, I feel like you could still make the point about power and corruption, but Garrison is a part of that corruption. He used his power to go after Clay Shaw, an innocent man. And again, I won't go into those details, but I am 100% certain on that. The tethers that they had on him on, I think he even knew he was innocent. I think he used the opportunity to exploit a man that didn't want to come out as gay so that he could then make his grandstanding statements to the press and make this grandstanding case. And I don't think he cared about who he hurt. It has also been alleged that Garrison was gay himself and was trying to prosecute other gay people because of things going on with him. That I will not comment on. I do not know. But there is a lot of speculation as to why Garrison was so certain Clay Shaw had something to do with this. But I don't think that any of it stands up in the light of the case or in this movie. I don't think Oliver Stone, for all his media manipulations, when we finally get to Tommy Lee Jones, I think we're supposed to think he's evil because he's so fey. I think that ultimately they use his homosexuality as something to be wary of.
Yeah, it feels so weird that you get this Sutherland scene where, you know, he's talking about the CIA evacuating Nazi intelligence, which, yes, that happened. We got some of those scientists, reused them. And like this New Zealand paper having all these details about Oswald before, you know, they should have had them. And then you go right into arresting Shaw. It feels like you've hit this pinnacle of like deep state. And then, oh no, we're going to go after the gay guy.
Yeah. And I really would like to have seen more explanation of what was there, more investigation after this encounter. But yeah, and I never took it as go after the gay guy, but I didn't understand what they had on Shaw and only Shaw. I would have thought if this is a conspiracy, you have multiple defendants. No, they only had Shaw. And Tommy Lee Jones giving one of the most restrained performances, yes. I could ever recall.
Except those pinky wags.
I don't feel like it's that restrained, but maybe for him. I don't know.
It's no Two-Face.
Okay. Yeah. If that's your frame of reference, it's better than Two-Face. Sure. But I feel like he's going big here. And I feel like Oliver Stone wouldn't have it any other way. I mean, that's when you're in an Oliver Stone movie, you go big.
Again, compare him to the warden in Natural Born Killers. This is almost like Jay from Men in Black restraint.
Yeah, I mean, I think Tommy Lee Jones in general is a stoic actor. If you look at his body of work, particularly the dramas, you're going to the sci-fi stuff, but his dramatic work, he is usually craggy, cranky, and downplaying the situation. Fugitive.
Yeah, The Fugitive, I don't think of him as over the top.
Yeah, I mean, this to me feels bigger than The Fugitive, and I feel like, again, he is trying to use the homosexual flourishes to have us hate him for it. I really do see a homophobia in this presentation. He is evil because of that, because we can't tie him to anything else. Now, their director's cut will involve him even in the civil rights movement, and he was trying to suppress blacks and voting, and they'll allege a lot, but none of it is true. What they had the guy on was a crazy guy that we shot up with truth serum, didn't mention his name until Jim Garrison kept putting him in a trance and say his name and making it part of the testimony.
What is Shaw arrested for? This I still don't understand. I get that, okay, you arrest who you can. It's like Al Capone. You go after him for tax evasion because you can't get him for anything else. So, okay, you go after one of the smaller players. I understand that. I don't really get what the charges are, because when we get to the court scene, I don't even understand what this has to do with Shaw. Like, of course he's going to get off.
Shaw funded Operation Mongoose, according to this movie. Operation Mongoose is where Ferry and Oswald trained and were preparing to invade Cuba.
Does this have something to do with Trademart? There's a lot about how he's the president of Trademart and they had some ties with Italy. Like, this is where I do get lost.
Again, because it's called inference. Again, we know that he was in San Francisco on November 22nd, 1963. Hundreds of people can vouch for that. What Oliver Stone needed, or what Jim Garrison needed, was a paper trail to follow the money from what he was doing financially and the funding of this group. And maybe then, if you could tie this group to the people that assassinated JFK, you could say Shaw is guilty. But keep in mind, this is being accused of treason. This man, if proven guilty, will die. You will have to execute him. You have to be goddamn sure you have a case in order to feel that kind of moral certitude and put that on a man.
And this movie never sells that to me. It never shows any hesitation to do it. It never shows any fear on the part of Shaw of if this were to go against him or anything. And you said follow the money. That's a famous line from All the President's Men. I felt like Donald Sutherland was trying so hard not to say follow the money because they said it. It was reminding me of Martin Sheen in The Amazing Spider-Man, really trying not to say with great power comes great responsibility. They were saying everything but follow the money. I'm like, oh, come on, guys. Be original.
I don't know about Spider-Man, but the connection between All the President's Men and this is obviously Nixon. I mean, Nixon looms over all of this, and Oliver Stone would end up making a film all about Nixon. He had axes to grind for Nixon, but not in this film. Nixon is considered possibly a co-conspirator to some people, but it's interesting that Stone doesn't go there here. Only an inference. He knows that he could get sued, for one thing, if he names a name, and he knows that he doesn't know. I mean, when you have Dave Ferry make that speech, it's an enigma wrapped in a riddle inside a mystery. It's an admission that I don't have the facts about who actually pulled the trigger. It doesn't matter. What Donald Sutherland, what I hear him say is, it doesn't matter who they got to do it. The point is, we are controlled by a military-industrial complex that feels war is profitable and will off people that stand in their way. That could be true. I do feel like that kind of cynical thinking is something that I can align with. That doesn't frighten me, even though I'm not sure that it meant that, again, to hear this movie, everyone was in on it.
Yeah, I don't think that means they're going to go after the president. They're going to sell their surplus to local police departments and militarize our police like they've done. Like, that's how the military-industrial complex turns a profit.
But again, if you keep in mind the fact that they got busted on the Bay of Pigs, and Kennedy was like, Nixon was going to do what? And you want me to do invade a country? I'm not going to do it. And you're all fired. Fired people, angry people, people that mobilize military force. Could they organize a coup d'etat? I didn't know what that expression was until I saw this movie. Yeah, I think that is, it may not be what happened, but I think that I can accept Stone's conclusion that as a possibility.
I agree. It does feel like more than the mafia would have needed to be involved.
I would just say from research that I can't get into, but I really got sucked in this past week, I really do feel like Oswald was hanging around not knowing what was being done in his name, thinking he was going to go to Cuba and was actually being set up for this job.
You know, before we get to the trial, like, we get one dissenting voice, I feel, from Broussard, Michael Rooker's character, and he brings up the point that I always make, like, how do you keep a secret with more than 12 people? Like, he becomes suspicious of the whole conspiracy thing.
And again, he had a scene where, like, I think it was his uncle or his dad had, like, picked him up, who's in the FBI, and it's just alleged that he, for reasons, wants to believe in that nobody inside our U.S. government would have these ill aims. That's just not possible. And of course, Costner is arguing, look at Julius Caesar. They have a scene that in the theatrical cut, it looks like Bill quits and we never see him again. But if you see the director's cut, he actually goes to collude with the FBI and try to set up Jim as he's coming back from L.A. in the LAX bathroom.
Were they trying to set him up as a homosexual? Like, you hear about, like, men hooking up in the bathrooms, you stick your foot in the stall. Like, that's how this played out. Like, there's two men.
Totally. Yeah, no, that's just want to point out in 1968 when this is happening, that if two men were messing around in a bathroom, cops would, yeah, bust their head, drag them into jail, make a big production out of it. They had hired somebody to be Jim Garrison's gay lover in the stall next door, and you saw 12 cops waiting outside, including Bill, to seal the deal. This is something Garrison put in his book. He alleged it was happening. He was alleging a lot of other paranoid things. Again, he believed that they were out to kill him. Maybe they were, but maybe it wasn't because of a government deep state conspiracy. Maybe it was just that he had acted so abhorrently and had so many enemies.
Maybe it was the gay mafia coming after him.
It could be. I mean, that's the way they want to see it. But again, being gay in this world means that he would be ruined. If they had caught him in this trap, it would mean the end of the investigation. But he's too smart for it. He runs out of the bathroom and we never see Bill again.
Too smart. Yeah, he just runs away. It's weird. Like, the cops don't really try to take him down. It plays out very weird.
Maybe that's why it wasn't in my cut of the film then.
Yeah, it deserved to be cut. All the things that are cut from the director's cut, I feel like sometimes I'm interested in things and they go on longer, but the big scenes, yeah, you don't need them. I feel like this movie is long.
Except for that Johnny Carson scene. I really like that scene.
Really? See, I feel like that one definitely could go. But, I mean, maybe you cut another scene so that one doesn't feel long there.
Maybe because I like John Larroquette's performance. Again, all these little cameos are a lot of fun most of the time.
The persecution of Garrison, what we are is, when you're creating a three-act structure, before we get to the climax, we have to portray that all is lost. And so Garrison is experiencing all these things where he's kicked out of the National Guard and the place is being bugged and his wife's going to leave him and two employees quit and evidence is disappearing. And you're supposed to think the reason why they go to trial without a case is that he's been ripped off. And he knows he doesn't have a case, but he's still going to, you know, make the case about a conspiracy, even though he probably knows that Shaw... Stone has said that anyway. He wants the audience to feel like this Garrison knows he's not going to win the case, but wants to win the bigger argument. There's two things being debated in the courtroom. One is, did Clay Shaw kill Kennedy or can he be connected? That can't be made and shouldn't be made. But then the larger case of, was Kennedy killed by someone other than Oswald? The jurors said that they were convinced of that. They felt like even though this was a sham trial that brought in the Zapruder film and all this other stuff, that was the stuff that made them believe that, yeah, the Warren report is incomplete. But to see the director's cut here, when you have the black guy on heroin trying to, like, say, like, I saw that guy, like, it's so thin. They have the Goldberg guy, Ron Rifkin. Remember how he says he was trying to connect them, but he fingerprints his daughter regularly because he wants to make sure.
Yes, I thought that was funny.
Yeah, I mean, that's a true story. These are the kinds of people that Garrison was bringing. A man that fingerprints his daughter when she comes home from college to make sure that she hasn't been replaced by a duplicate. Paranoids, crazies, freaks. If this movie ran with that impulse and ran with the dark humor of that, I'm trying to think of who would be good at that. Maybe John Waters. But if John Waters had made JFK in 1991.
Oh boy, there would have been shit eating and eggs.
Yeah, I mean, like, Divine would have probably been like Jackie O or something like that.
Oh, that would have been great. Divine as Jackie O. I want that.
And maybe that's an ill taste. Maybe we can't laugh about the Kennedy killing, all of that stuff. There's a way of doing dark comedy. And I do feel like the story of Jim Garrison, if not JFK, is dark comedy. His trial is sham, and that Stone is trying to clean it up here in a montage and make it seem like, I don't know, he has something. I think it's pretty evident to everyone that this man should go free. No one should be put to death because of what these people say on the stand.
Yeah, if I was the judge and I'm listening to Back and to the Left, back, like, this, nothing, none of this has anything to do with Shaw, I'd throw Garrison out. I'd have him disbarred.
Seriously, I am not a lawyer. I watch a lot of law TV. That's all the expertise I have. But for some reason, I feel that no judge would allow such an indulgence as to be discussing something so irrelevant to the defendant at hand and to take up so much of the court's valuable time. Court cases are backlogged for months and years, and they're just going to let this guy do this?
But they did, Arnie. This part is true. They pulled it out of the Time Life vault and aired it for the jurists. I mean, like, that was allowed to happen. Now, there was a lot of eye rolling and a lot of people looking at each other, but you have to realize the power of being the district attorney. This wasn't just some Joe Schmo lawyer. This wasn't John Candy handling the case.
I'm glad we get to see John Candy come back and take the stand.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to tell them there's no Clay Bertrand.
Listen, Daddy-O.
Yeah, Daddy-O, I made it all up. Nope, not listening to it. You're in perjury. Tell us who it is.
And here's the thing. If the point of this case, if the power of this case was that it got out to the public that, okay, maybe it wasn't Oswald or there was other people besides him, make the movie about that, he knew it was a sham, but he was getting, this is the only way to get that truth out there. I have problems with this narrative.
Stone said he made that movie. That's what he hopes people conclude from what is happening here. That by Costner focusing more on these details, that he is not trying to put Clay away so much as make his case to not only the jurist. I mean, he's looking right at the audience in this closing statement here. He's trying to tell people, you need to get involved in your government. Look at what's going on here. You out there eating your popcorn, put it down, go read the books, go read the Warren Commission, do the work that I have. I feel like it's an activist call. It's not a call to put someone to death. It's a call to say, wake up.
That is slightly undermined when Garrison loses the case.
You think so?
I feel like it's not a home run to be like, hey, here's all my evidence. The jury finds against you.
I mean, we knew it was going to go this way, just historically speaking. I mean, it's not accepted that anyone other than Oswald by the Warren Commission. Yeah, right. There have been other committees and things got released. We'll talk about that in a bit. But I do feel like he lost the battle but won the war, right? Like, that's the way it comes off here. He gets to go home, and then eventually, and again, this work wasn't done by Garrison. Lots of people were writing about how this doesn't add up. It'd be one thing if he was the only one that believed. They want to make it seem like this court case was essential in getting the word out. But the truth is that Garrison was an opportunist jumping on a trend that was already fomenting in a revolutionary 60s where the youth was rebelling against the old in lots of ways. So again, I think it's just very convenient for Oliver Stone to make Garrison his proxy for making a hippie message. That's what he does here in the courtroom. And if it hurt this gay guy that no one's ever heard of, and well, he never went to jail, so don't worry about it. I think that's kind of the way it comes off to me.
Well, when Tommy Lee Jones is being interviewed after, and they're like, what's he going to do now? I'm just thinking, and maybe it's because of too much live court TV now and things, I'm thinking, this guy's got to be impoverished. I mean, the cost of his defense had to eat his every dollar. This guy, what's he going to do now? I don't know, write a book about it to try to make some money back?
Yeah, he was ruined. And again, having your name in the paper as a homosexual in this way in Southern proper society in 1969 is not a victory. They say he had the reason why he died a few years later was the stress and he became a reclusive person. Again, lives were ruined by what Garrison did. Lots of people had bad ends.
But for Stone, Shaw died in 1974 of cancer. No autopsy was allowed. It feels like he's still pointing the finger.
Yeah.
There's still something sinister going on. Still don't trust him.
Yeah, I didn't want to get into it, but some of what Crossfire gets into was the fact that in trying to kill Castro, the CIA was working on all kinds of drugs, and some of them were rapidly give people cancer and kill them. And there is a researcher that came forward that said, I was Oswald's lover in New Orleans, and I developed that cancer killer. So it's out there. That is exactly what Stone is getting at. That no death here is innocuous and natural causes. It's always the deep state. You always need to be on your guard and suspicious when these things happen, because all around you, your safe suburbia that my wife tries to live in is a lie.
What's funny is I feel like that paranoia grew through the 90s. And then we had 9/11 and everybody was like, yeah, what were we so worried about in the 90s?
Relative peace. We got bored and we had to make up problems.
Yeah, it feels that way now. I do feel like it was a lot of infighting at the time. Family values and Congress versus Clinton. And for lots of reasons, there was partisan divide. But you're right. Like, it was put in perspective in the 21st century. But it wouldn't be an Oliver Stone movie if he didn't end this trial with statistics about Vietnam. To him, what comes out of all of this is that so many people died in that unnecessary war.
And a lot of helicopters sold.
Yes, and so many other people profited with their choppers and bombs.
And Stone profited big from this movie, as you mentioned, Stuart, but did he deserve to? Jacob, Stuart, do you recommend JFK? Jacob.
All right, I'm going to try to draw a comparison here. I'm going to try to be fair and balanced. Jade Helm 15. I don't know if you guys remember this during the Obama administration. Apparently, Obama was going to have a coup. He was going to have the military use underground tunnels connected to Walmarts to take over America.
I missed that one.
Oh, Ted Cruz came out and said, we demand to know if this is really a thing. And I remember I had an uncle saying, we got to look into this.
Speaking of Ted Cruz, supposedly his father hung out with Oswald in New Orleans. He was part of that military group.
Well, and Ted Cruz is the Zodiac killer. So there you go. I said to my uncle, I'm like, this is patently ridiculous. Like, there's no way this is true. And he's like, well, you can't trust Obama. He's up to a lot of weird stuff. I'm like, well, then just tell the truth. Like, if he's up to this bad stuff, then just tell the truth. That's going to help your cause a whole lot more than making up lies or these wild conspiracies. Now, on the other side, at the time of this recording, we just got the sequel to Borat. I know this is a weird comparison, Jade Helm 15 and Borat.
I haven't seen it yet, but I want to.
Just before it came out, there was this big story. Giuliani touched himself while talking to someone who he thought was an underage girl. It's going to be this big scandal. And then I watched it. It doesn't really play out that way. It seems like it was hyped either for publicity or to take Giuliani down. Like, I don't like Giuliani. I want him to go down, but I got to be fair and balanced here. The evidence doesn't play out, and it hurts that film for me, and it hurts Sacha Baron Cohen's credibility because of that. That's kind of my bias coming into this film. If there are evil, conspiratorial, wicked things going on, and we need to shed the light of truth upon that, whatever truth means in this age of 2020 fake news and all that, then just tell the truth. When you just throw everything in there and just go, look, there's a lot of weird stuff going on there. There is with the JFK assassination. I get that. There is a lot of weird stuff. But when you throw it all in and you have this really weird anti-gay slant to it as well, like that did bother me throughout the film. Like its obsession with homosexuality and what the homosexuals were doing to get back at JFK, these very Republican homosexuals, not the way you usually think of their politics. I guess they're a log cabin ones. For me and my bias, when I approach someone who buys into conspiratorial thinking, it just hurts your message. Like, yeah, maybe this was revolutionary in 1991 that there was more than one shooter, or maybe it wasn't Oswald at all. I want to see a better portrayal of that. And that really hurt this film for me. I think a lot of people that buy into conspiratorial thinking, it's almost like religious thinking. You got to make sense of the chaos in this world. And so you pull all these, connect all these dots and pull all these strings until something makes sense, even though that truth you've developed is very strange. And this comes off as a religious nut ranting about something to me. And so despite like all these performances I like, they're all just checkered throughout the film. Nothing's tied together. It's just random thoughts coming out to me the whole time. I wish there was more narrative here.
Do you wish that he had said exactly what he believed as opposed to giving the floor to lots of different theories?
Yeah, I think that would have helped. Or if the whole point of Shaw's trial was to just shed light, to bring this out into public knowledge, even though it sounds like it was public knowledge, but maybe to give some of these theories more credibility and say, hey, don't buy the Warren Commission, then make the movie about that. This movie is about too much, ultimately, in my opinion. And it says nothing, and it hurts the credibility of whatever the truth is behind the JFK assassination. So I guess if you're really into conspiratorial thinking, you'll probably enjoy this film. For me, I was on guard the whole time because I was told at the beginning I got to critically think and question things. And so I'm questioning the person that's telling me to question things as well. Like that's what I do. And so for me, it's damaged by that. It's listening to a madman raving most of the time. Again, I like the editing. I like a lot of the performances. John Candy's great here, but it's not a recommend.
Stuart.
And to me, JFK represents the best and the worst about Oliver Stone as a filmmaker, you know, the cinematic historian. You're right. He does tell us, reach your own conclusions, but obviously this is propaganda, and he's good at it. Again, propaganda, I mean, you could argue that everyone has their own version that they're putting out there. He is emphatically trying to get you. The reason why I don't feel threatened about it is I don't feel like he's getting you to think of a certain killer or a certain slant on this. He is not solving the case definitively. He's just asking you to consider the multiple discrepancies. Just look at what they tell you and then look at everything else and ask yourself if the people that are in charge are being honest with you. I think that that is a message that's very fair, even though there's a lot of bullshit in this movie. And I think, personally, this movie's really intriguing. Masterful is the word. And working all those angles, taking all that information, and turning it into 3 hours of concentrated, absorbing, challenging, to me, largely comprehensible conspiracy, I felt like I could really get a handle on the JFK case. To me, it feels like a good primer. If I hadn't done what Stone had told me to and gone and done more research and look into it, I would say this is a very solid recommend. But kind of like how there's two shooters at Dealey Plaza, there's two arrows in my review. And the other one is burning red. While I'm giving it a solid green, I also fucking hate this movie because it does so disregard widely accepted facts.
Oh, I was so mad when I started Googling stuff after this.
Again, and I think Oliver Stone even knows it. It doesn't bother him that he's slandering somebody who's innocent of these charges Garrison is putting forth, because this storyline allows him to make larger sanctimonious points. And so it's the cost of the messaging that he has to go through this imperfect person and turn Garrison into Atticus Finch, which to me is like the militia that kidnapped Gretchen Whitmer. You want to put someone on trial who is not guilty of what you're saying and kill them. And I think that that is horrible. I think that is an abuse of power in and of itself. It is to me as offensive as the Warren Commission is to Oliver Stone. So how do I rectify these two sentiments? Where am I going to ultimately land? A stirring movie that asks important questions about a pivotal moment in history, yet resorts to gay bashing and outrageous lies to assert its version of the truth. I think because I'm passionate, I recognize that that means it's effective. In the end, I'm recommending the experience. I think people need to go see it and experience it. And I think that that makes it a green arrow because I had this reaction and I'm pulled in so many ways. I'm not bored. I'm not bored by this movie. To me, it is not 3 hours of a history teacher I don't want to hear. It is a very probing, challenging, sometimes ridiculous, but always compelling piece of agitprop. And so even though I would prefer that dark comedy version of Garrison's trial, I will accept this whitewashing because I do think it gets to some truths about American power and corruption. So it's a recommend.
And I'm going to take away from my review of this film truth, because I still don't think we know the truth about who killed JFK. I think that there's a lot of theories floating around out there. This movie gives you some. The Warren Commission gives you some. Reddit will give you an endless amount, not many of which I believe. But to say here's what really happened, I'm going to take that out. To say don't trust what the official account is, as you're saying, Stuart, I think I was distrustful of authority long before I saw this movie. I never believed what I was being told. So I had that from elsewhere. But really, I'm going to judge this as a film, as in not a documentary, but a dramatic storytelling film. And I don't think it works on that level. If you don't care about the assassination of JFK, this isn't going to make you care about the people surrounding this investigation. It's not going to make you care about Kennedy himself. You have to be pre-sold on this topic before you even see this movie in order to hope that you have a chance of enjoying yourself or at least being interested in the experience of this movie. to me, you've got the greatest ensemble of performers that I think have ever been in the same movie together, unlike movie 43, which you referenced, Jacob, which had some good, but also some shit. Here, everybody here is an amazing name and a recognizable face, and they're just given so little to do except to give this exposition about one possible conspiracy that I've learned from you, Stuart, lionizes a villain in the form of Jim Garrison. I didn't enjoy the experience of this film. I really didn't. I would have rather watched a documentary exploring theories of JFK's killing instead of this hyper-edited, super-focused version. To me, this is Stone at his most pious and unwatchable. It's a not recommend.
Most pious? Jesus, that's a tall order. I don't know. He's usually pious. That is his stance. I find it surprising you could argue with the filmmaking, because it is so persuasive. That's what makes it dangerous. You could call it unethical, but to call it bad filmmaking, I don't know. I don't see that at all.
I don't see human drama in this film, and I feel that maybe Stone should have streamlined some of the conspiracy. Instead of having quite so many lines trying to tie all the way around to Shaw, he could have streamlined it a little bit. He could have had A go to B, go to C, go to D. I did rewatch All the President's Men after seeing this movie because I wanted to see. I kept seeing that. All the President's Men kept its investigation very straightforward. I doubt Woodward and Bernstein's investigation was actually so linear as it is presented in that movie. I'm sure that they were gathering evidence from all over. And yes, again, looked like that billboard from Always Sunny in Philadelphia. But it was told in a linear manner that allowed you to root for the investigators more and completely follow everything that was going on, as many players as were pulled into it time and time again. And here, I feel Stone gets muddled in that second hour, and I just can't stand a half an hour of Kevin Costner lecturing to me back and to the left, back and to the left.
If they hadn't had the court case at the end, would you have recommended the movie?
No, because I had decided my experience with this movie was not an enjoyable one by the midpoint, long before. I knew the trial was coming, and I wondered if I might enjoy the trial. I wondered if it might be funny or if it might be engaging.
I usually like trial scenes. That's one of the things in The Aviator I did like.
Yeah, and I like court movies, so I was looking forward to it. But by the midpoint of this movie, I realized I wasn't enjoying the investigation, and the investigation is 5/6 of the film.
Yeah, I don't know how you would dramatize this information any other way.
Have you seen Spotlight? That is about an investigation, a bunch of newspaper people checking out sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. Like, that is a drama to me. That I didn't feel like I was reading a Reddit message board with that film.
Yeah, it's a very good film.
I'm just saying there's a way to do this kind of film and have drama, make it have a narrative and make it dramatic, not have it feel like a college lecture.
Again, I don't even think that that's a bad thing. I'm cool with people bending the art form of film so that it becomes more like a film essay.
I'm cool if it works. It didn't work for me here.
I'll tell you what doesn't work. Don't watch Ruby. Like, the ripoff that you really should avoid that I went back to is Danny Aiello and Audrey from Twin Peaks tried to tell you about the man who killed the man who killed JFK. And it's awful.
Yeah, I watched that movie when it came out. I was deep in my Twin Peaks phase. Sherilyn Fenn was one of the top billed. And I remember really not going with that one either. You know, Danny Aiello, I think, was very well cast.
You're remembering it nicer than you should.
When it came to the killing of Oswald, I didn't feel like the movie led up to that enough.
It certainly did.
One other thing I do want to call out about this movie, though, I want to end on a compliment for it. I really liked the score. And it was bugging me. There were like parts of this movie where I'd have to pause because it would go like, da 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 da. And I'm like, I know that music. Did Williams reuse this later? Where did he use this earlier and brought it back here? Because I'd hear in my head, Randy Andy Edelman ripped him off when he did the score for Dragon the Bruce Lee Story. Many of these notes are verbatim the main theme from Dragon the Bruce Lee Story.
It did shock me that this was Williams, because the stuff that stuck out to me is just more percussive, you know, is during the more intense moments. And I just didn't associate that with Williams. It didn't have so much the strings, just more, again, drums and that.
Sad horns and snare drums. And Arnie, I don't know, like, that's always your participation medal, right? Like, the score, I can give you something for a score. I feel like you give out that prize a lot, and it doesn't feel like you're complimenting that much.
No, but I really did enjoy the music here. Here's the thing, is I enjoyed it as a piece of music because I listened to the Dragon score pretty regularly just as good listening music, and it turned out it originated here.
That's off the rotation. JFK's on.
Yeah, pretty much.
It should be said, whatever you think of that, this movie, it did change history. It did get George Bush Sr., whose father did help create the CIA, and yeah.
Oh, I heard he was part of this conspiracy too, according to some people.
Yeah, he was willing to review all the documents, declassify them, start making them public by 2017. Ironically, Jim Garrison would die the same month that this act was done, so he never learned anything what we've learned, but it has happened. Trump has slowly released. It's been a rolling public release.
Yeah, he did block some of them coming out for national security concerns. And going back to what Arnie said, that like they were worried about a war starting, I read summaries. I didn't read the actual papers. Stone would be very upset with me, but I read summaries, and it just did seem like a lot of like, we don't want this getting out, that we had plots against Cuba and this country and that, because it's going to make us look bad.
It's not that they plotted against Cuba. Of course we hated Cuba. They were communist and 90 miles away. It's the fact that, and again, I think this is a huge scandal. It may be why we didn't have a good investigation on this. The fact that the CIA was working hand in hand with the mafia, and on some level, the Kennedys knew that, is just bad. That looks bad. So that does seem to be the thing that they were covering up. Not who killed Kennedy, which again, probably was mafia, but the fact that we even got in bed with the five families, Sinatra, all that shit. It's remarkable. That has been most of what's come out. There is one more stash of stuff. The rest of it is coming out next October.
So we don't have to wait till 2038. I thought we were going to have a big reunion then if we were still around.
No, it should all be known what is going to be known. And I think we all know we'll never know. I mean, I think on some level, this is a forever enigma.
Oh, I feel like they knew back then, and it's all in that envelope. Otherwise, why would they seal it until everyone involved is dead?
Maybe they did do that. Maybe we'll get to the vault and find it's gone like Capone. I don't know what will be there, but I will be curious. I will be happy to be wrong if we do get the smoking gun or guns next October. It would be quite a thing to know.
But in the meantime, next week, we're going to sit down for Thanksgiving with Sidney Poitier.
And boy, Arnie, if you don't like people making 10-minute speeches, God help you and Spencer Tracy, because when we get invited to dinner, it's his table. Let me tell you, he's going to own that climax.
Isn't this like the pilot episode of All in the Family?
In a certain way, I suppose you could look at it that way. Yes. Sidney Poitier, Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, Katharine Ross. It's a classic, and it has been requested by one of you patrons, so we're tagging it on. It seemed like a good thing to bring out around Thanksgiving.
Yes, because that's when the best conversations go on with the family around the dinner table.
Well, the difficult ones, right? Like, that's the uneasy things that come about. I think that this movie has a light way of handling contentious politics. It dealt with interracial relationships back when that was still a crime.
So we will be discussing that next week. In the meantime, thank you again to Sean for picking JFK and giving us a chance to delve back into history, and Oliver Stone. I do think you may have picked his movie that I like least.
Now, you haven't seen Heaven and Earth. Don't even start.
Of all the films I've seen of his, I'll put that in there.
I could bring you some that I'm sure you would hate more.
You haven't seen Savages either. Ugh.
I would much rather review U-Turn, I'll say that much. And thank you to every single one of our patrons who has donated to listen to this show. And yes, you get an extra helping of exclusive shows next week with Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So thank you for listening to Now Playing, the podcast that once you're in, we got you for life.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Why do we have to leave? Don't you love us anymore?
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
You're the cream in my coffee.
And we want to wish a special thank you to Sean Ray for his tremendous support of our show and for picking JFK for this patron-exclusive review.
One likes friends that have friends.
Indeed.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
It's one of the sloppiest, most disorganized investigations I've ever seen.
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
Gentlemen, will you please rise and follow me?
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
I guess my reputation's all right with people watching and laughing.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
I'm just a patsy.
Now Playing is edited by Steven and Arnie.
Time just stands still here, like a snake, sun itself on the road.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
Nobody knows what we're talking about here, Jack.
You are so naive.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
The bigger the lie, the more people will believe it.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein.
I don't know what I am charged with, but I emphatically deny these charges.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
You're starting to get paranoid. You really are.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
But this sort of thing could be so easily misunderstood.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
The day that communist son of a bitch died was a great day for this country. And I just hate to think that they blame it on some silly fucking Oswald. Didn't know shit anyway, man. People got to know. People got to know why he was killed. Because he was a communist.
One possible conspiracy that I've learned from you, Stuart, lionizes a villain in the form of, I keep wanting to call him Gaffigan.
It's not Jim Gaffigan.
Ah, Pocket.
But by the time we got to the killing of Osborn, I didn't feel...
Oswald. Norman Osborn is in the Spider-Man movie all of a sudden.
Are you really confusing this with Spider-Man again?
Jim Gaffigan, Norman Osborn.
He's got Ben Parker on the mind. He had that old analogy.
God.
When did Spider-Man stop the assassination? I was waiting for that moment.
This needed web, more web swinging, and he would have been into this movie. Okay. Noted.